Tonight on The Download, Chicago playwright Dan Noonan, music video director Aziz Alaka, and another installment of the Swap Meet with Greg Flam. Now, here's your host, a man who has always wanted to be in a Mariah Carey video, Justin Kaufman.
Who are your sources? No. I mean, yes. Of course, yes. Who wouldn't? There was a funny story about that, when I was doing comedy and we're in L.A., everyone was saying, what's going to be your first purchase when you get something? You know, at what point do you think you're at success? And my joke was always, and I was serious about it, I wanted to be the foil in a Mariah Carey video. You know, like one that has a plot. You know, maybe I'm the janitor mopping the floor. Those are the best, right? Those are the best when the character actor you like is in it. And you're like, oh. And then, and I kid you not, Mariah Carey did one of those videos, and Jack McBrayer. This is, I mean, really at the beginning of 30 Rock. But Jack McBrayer was the foil. He got the part. And I'm like, I was joking. I was like, that's a pie in the sky. That's a dream thing. That's probably never going to actually materialize. Not only does it materialize, but a Chicago improviser got the gig. And good for Jack, but I feel like somewhere along the line, I put that kernel in someone's mind. In L.A., they're like, that's not a bad idea. Who do we know that's better than Justin? Jack. I mean, it's great. I forgot what video it was, but he's like on the bed and he's like, he's pretending like he's fixing the computer or something. And he's like, it's just a comedy bit while she does her video. And that could have been me. If I'd have made a couple of different choices in my life, I feel like I could have been in that Mariah Carey video. I don't know. How's everybody doing tonight? It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. We have one of the more eclectic shows lined up tonight. And I always love when that happens, right? I mean, we find ourselves all the time trying to present variety and diversity and really get out of the same old categories of talk radio. And tonight is no exception. There are so many great stories, and today, just researching and prepping and getting ready for these things, I have to say my head's spinning. At one point, I'm watching drill rap videos from Chicago hip-hop artists from the South Side who are doing it themselves, DIY rap videos from artists that you may or may not have ever heard of that are getting 8 to 10 million likes on YouTube. We're going to have one of those film directors in studio tonight from Laka Films, Aziz Alaka, will be here. And I am so into this story because it is, when you see the video, videos, there's hundreds of them. It shows how prolific they are, Laka Films. But it also shows, it gives you a glimpse into a world you may not be familiar with. Young African-American hip-hop artists on the South Side with very little money to be able to produce. They're not these shiny, glossy music videos you see or used to see on MTV. These are DIY videos they put together for their hip-hop tracks that they're producing out of their homes. And it is so interesting and good. I give a lot of credit to Laka Films. I look at them like, this is good stuff. Also has a lot of questionable material in it, but I'm going to try not to be dad. This conversation tonight coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. You know, before we start, I need to talk to you, Aziz. Way too much swearing. Put a shirt on, guys. That's coming up tonight. Also tonight, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but we've never had the folks from Clickhole on the program. Clickhole, the video arm of The Onion, right here in Chicago, that a viral video company, I love how they say this, it's like a viral video company that has already predetermined that it's going to go viral. That's their job. They're essentially making and parodying shareable content. So think Upworthy or BuzzFeed, the top 10 things you should know, in a little video that you see on your Facebook feed all the time and you click on it to see it. They're parodying that. They're creating characters and videos that are so specific and so almost camouflaged that you think it's the real thing. For instance, they have a new campaign with a senator from California. Senator, I think it's a, I forgot the name. I have it in a Anita something. But it looks like every video you see of Kamala Harris or Cory Booker, they put the language the same way, and they've been able to fake the background so it looks like she's making a speech. And the speech is usually it's usually her talking about how viral this speech is going to go. She's not actually having any content. It's a great Onion bit, great Clickhole bit. So we'll talk with two of the writers from Clickhole tonight about their approach to equal opportunity political satire and parody. That's coming up 9 o'clock hour. 8 o'clock tonight, playwright Dan Noonan's in studio. I love Dan. Dan's one of my favorites, friend of mine who is a playwright who has embarked on the journey to begin his own theater company. He's done so many great plays and he's done so many great stage readings of plays. He enters festivals and competitions and he'll have stage readings. But at the end of the day, he's always trying to get a theater company to produce his plays. So what does he do? He makes his own theater company. He gets with one of his creative partners and says, you know what? Let's do this. And there is a new company that the first show is on stage in Evanston. And we'll talk to Dan. Dan Noonan is a very special guy and one that I was telling the story to Dan and Anna, a story that is way beyond just theater and plays. A lot of his plays have to do with characters that are dealing with health issues and having to overcome. In Dan's life, he's had to do that for real. When he was 13 years old, he was born as severe hemophiliac, his hemophilia. And what that is that I don't know the technical determination, but your blood doesn't clot the way that it should. So essentially, if you bump into something or you bruise, your body can't handle it, so you have to get transfusions. You know, and as a young boy, think about that. And I know many parents who are listening right now who may have a child or a relative that was a child who has hemophilia. You know what that's like. Well, imagine having hemophilia in the 80s when the HIV/AIDS craze was starting, and the doctors and the blood banks and everybody who was in charge of that had yet to realize that the virus was spread from tainted blood. And so these kids, Dan included, were getting transfusions for the hemophilia, and Dan contracted HIV. He became HIV positive at 13 years old. There's famous stories of that, and a lot of the kids and adults at that time that happened to, they perished. And Dan, for perseverance and medicine and drugs and faith, is still with us. And so he takes that challenge, which is a big challenge in anybody's life. I mean, I can't even imagine the horror of that. And he uses it for his art. And so we'll talk with him at the big table tonight about what he's doing right now with his plays, but also about how he takes his personal, his struggles with health and hemophilia and also HIV and how that processes itself into the creative process. Dan Noonan, my guest at the big table tonight, 8 o'clock hour. Coming up at 7:30 today, this is actually a story that's in the news. The mayor, he got a little bit of flack last year when he said, you know what, if you're a CPS student, you have to have a plan to go to college. That is going to be a graduation requirement. If you do not have a plan, if your plan is to just lounge or not have some sort of further education, you cannot graduate from CPS. You cannot get a diploma. And that's very stark. And there are a lot of questions about whether or not that could be handled. And we've had conversations about that as well with our friends from Skills for Chicagoland's Future came in here. We talked about what that means. And also, as more and more kids enter college, are they prepared to finish college? Are they in a position where they can become prepared for the workforce? Or is this just a stunt that you get you sign up and you say, I'm going to go to this college, and you go for a half a semester and then you're done? The mayor today announced that he was making tweaks to that program because he recognized that there weren't enough counselors, guidance counselors, available for these kids. How are you going to say, let's get everybody applying for colleges and everybody meeting this requirement when you don't have enough people to actually help the kids? So he's going to borrow some guidance counselors from the city colleges to come in and help. But for me, I think it's a bigger question about Is society ready for a sea change? Anyone who has a kid who's 17, 18, 19 years old, are we in a position where we have to start thinking about more guidance and support and resources available for kids in college? Because the old adage was, when you're 18, you're college, everything else, you're on your own. You finish that up and then you're ready for the workforce. But it's not like that anymore. It's changing. And so we'll, you know, Skills for Chicago in the Future will be here, and we'll talk about what is needed for the college kid to get ready for the workforce and to avoid unemployment. There's a big Beyond the Diploma initiative that the mayor announced last month as well. So we'll talk with them coming up here in the 7:30 segment. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. I forgot about the swap meet. Swap meet's at 10 o'clock. How can I forget about the swap meet? It's going to be so good. Find out how much my Yo MTV Rap shirt's going for. See if it's maturing. We'll do that at 10 o'clock tonight. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll do the carry out. Stay with us. It's A Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. You know, if you're like me, you wonder what Bruce Rauner is doing with all that campaign money, right? I mean, $350,000 a day? Well, for starters, he's putting out a 14-minute ad to Run This Weekend featuring the, quote, unedited FBI wiretaps of the phone calls between J.B. Pritzker and Governor Rod Blagojevich. It's going to run in major markets both Saturday and Sunday. First off, where do you air a 14-minute ad? I swear, if you preempt my reruns of Reba, I'm going to lose it. The ad makes a big point of saying that the tapes are unedited, but then it jumps around and just skips part of the convo. I can't tell if this is super desperate or super boring. I don't know. The ad at the end says, there's more. There's so much more. You didn't have the money to take out a 30-minute ad? Why not give it all? Why stop there? Go for a full feature length, 2 hours, and then enter it into film festivals. Right? Come on. The problem with this ad is that they're trying to associate Pritzker to the imprisoned Rod Blagojevich, and that's it. It seems like a politician calling the sitting governor asking to be considered for state treasurer. All right. If anything, I mean, what's the harm? I get it. I understand Blagojevich is toxic. But if anything, this could backfire and put Pritzker's Blago issue to bed once and for all. Or Rauner's just banking on voters just hearing Blago's voice and calling it a day. And that's where we're at. I mean, I listened to the 14-minute ad. I was surprised that I made it. After about 3 minutes, I'm like, I don't care. Former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson endorsed State Senator Daniel Biss for governor today. Wait, an endorsement during the campaign? I thought endorsements came before the campaign to let everybody else know they shouldn't run. Isn't that how we do things? Looking in your direction. I coughed too early. Madigan. Speaking of Madigan, Rauner signed an executive order today making property tax appeals illegal if brought up by attorneys serving in the legislature. I wonder who that's for. I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with that sentiment, but it seems like we're now at stage 12 of political hell, where whatever Rauner does is strictly to take on Mike Madigan. I mean, why not try to get a bill passed so we can at least get Madigan on the record squashing it? Nope. So what's next? Rauner going to sign a new executive order outlawing gaveling? Can't gavel in? Two high-ranking congressional Democrats came out and endorsed a challenger to fellow Democrat Dan Lipinski. Lipinski's a Democrat, but many in his party believe he shows Republican tendencies. So what's it mean? Well, it means Luis Gutierrez and Jan Schakowsky just made the Illinois Democrat delegation bus rides awkward. Does Lipinski just get on and sit in the front, one solitary tear coming on his eye? This is a story to watch. The Sun-Times investigation uncovered that then-Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez consulted campaign staff before she brought charges against police officer Jason Van Dyke in the shooting of Laquan McDonald. That's what most conspiracy theories are looking for, right? That the reason the video and then the charges didn't come out sooner was because of optics and re-election campaigns. Turned out Alvarez was given talking points and instructions on what to say and not to say around the case. She ended up losing her re-election bid, but I think there's still questions about how politics and butt-saving, that's right, I said it, butt-saving, played out with our local leadership. Looks like Chicago's a finalist for the second headquarters of Amazon. Wow, whatever happens, we've already done better than the Olympic bid, so that's good. But wait, does finalist mean we're being considered, or is it just a fancy way to honor all the cities that originally entered? There are 19 other cities that are finalists. Really? I mean, why not just announce the city that you're moving to? Why did this turn into the BAFTA Awards? And the nominees for second headquarters are dun, 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 Chicago, Illinois. Topeka, Kansas. They do that for half an hour. Also, when hearing the news, Governor Rauner knocked the state of Illinois, saying that Jeff Bezos won't come here because of our high taxes. Essentially, he made it a negative campaign ad with letting border state governors slam us and now publicly trash-talking our state landing Amazon. What's up? Does this guy, I mean, he really hates this state that he wants to lead, doesn't he? Again. Maybe a new slogan. 4 more years of this hellhole job. Speaking of Olympics, disgraced Dr. Larry Nassar asked the judge to remove him from listening to victims during a sentencing hearing. I guess he couldn't handle it mentally. I say when he goes to jail for another 50 years, you put him in isolation, just put those stories on a loop. And Nassar aside for a second, I'm still not convinced that U.S. gymnastics isn't evil personified. This dude allegedly molested 140 girls. Is that the number? I know he did some outside of U.S. gymnastics, but 140? All gymnasts? And they're giving settlements to said gymnasts with non-disclosure saying they can't tell their story? What? Why? Because you make a ton of money off these preteen girls, and if it was revealed that you really didn't care about them, and in this case, really didn't care, then we would stop sending kids your way and stop watching the sport entirely, and the money would dry up. I mean, think about it. Russian athletes took a banned substance, and they're out of the Olympics. I'd be okay with the Summer Olympics without gymnastics at this point. It'd give me a chance to give the old archery team another look, right? And it's not a full death sentence for the sport. I mean, look at Penn State. You don't get to play in a couple bowl games, and then we just forget. There you go. It's a ridiculous story. The more that comes out, wow. Why did I make it to the first part of the carryout not talking about the president? Well, he's not going to like that. So here goes. Out of one of the more weirder, quieter details coming out of the affair Mr. Trump had with the adult film star Stormy Daniels is that he forced her to watch hours of the show Shark Tank and for her to spank him with a copy of Forbes magazine that he and his family were on the cover of. Well, that's the punchline. I don't know how you make that any better. Hashtag real news. In weather, looks like we're settling into a contemporary winter. You know the kind where it's about 35 degrees with occasional rain till May. That's where we're at. In sports, the Bulls get a little buzz for staying close to the Warriors in last night's loss. ESPN went with the headline, Warriors get past pesky Bulls. Pesky? That's an upgrade, right? The bad news for the Bulls is that guards Chris Dunn dunked the ball and then fell on his mouth, smashing in his teeth. No word on how long he's going to be out. What is a dental injury classified as? Upper body? Right? He's out tonight with a sprained tooth. Well, they say concussion, but I like torn teeth better. Dislocated teeth. All right. Matt Nagy introduced his coordinators today at Hallis Hall. Vic Fangio did some bits, then reporters laughed, and we're off and running with a new coaching staff. New offensive coordinator Mark Helfrich said that the good news is that quarterback Mitch Trubisky is coachable, which is both a knock at Trubisky and Jay Cutler, both in the same. Coachable. The combo platter. All right. There you go. Mel Kiper, the draft guru, he's out with his latest NFL draft projection. He goes way out on a limb and says the Bears will pick Alabama wide receiver Calvin Ridley with the 8th overall. Yes, the Bears need wide receiver help bad, but am I the only fan who doesn't want to relive another Kevin White debacle? Or David Terrell or Curtis Conway? I mean, you get the picture. The Bears have not drafted well at that position because most top 10 wide receivers don't pan out. Look at the last couple years. I say draft defense. I like when they draft defense. Pass rushers, safeties, corners, linebackers, steaks, pork chops, pot roast nachos. That's what we like. All right. And finally tonight, can I do my Starbucks joke one more time from last night? Just because we did it late last night after the game. And Ken Pete, can we? We do it one more time? He says, all right, good. All right, here we go. The new Starbucks on Michigan Avenue that will be taking over the Crate and Barrel, and when completed, it'll be the biggest Starbucks in the world. Wow. Yes. there's going to be so much more room for Cream. That's good, right? Come on. Oh, that's the carryout for January 18th, 2018. We don't have Cream for our coffee. We've got non-dairy creamer in little pouches that have been shoved in the back of the stockroom since 1960. So take two. You can have them. Coming up, we'll talk youth unemployment, beyond the diploma. Also at 8 o'clock, Dan Noonan joins us, the playwright. Talk about his new theater company. And so much more. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you tonight, buddy?
Oh, man, so good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm looking forward to a very eclectic show tonight.
I
feel
like it.
I'm a little anxious because I feel like I'm going to ask the wrong questions to the wrong segments.
Hey, you know what? I gave the wrong forecast the other night.
That was my favorite point. That was my favorite of 2018, by the way. Because you're like, it's going to be 50 tomorrow.
Yeah, it's going to be real warm.
It is. I don't know if it is, but Rob's he's the pro.
And you know what? Thank God for Pete, because he goes, Rob, was that last week's forecast? I did a quick check. I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's last week's forecast.
Yeah, but you know what, man?
But it sounded so good, I went with it.
It was, and I'm surprised it didn't make the president's fake news awards.
Oh, well. Sorry about that.
It's all good. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we've got Dan Noonan's going to be here, playwright. He'll be my guest at the big table. We've got a ton of stuff tonight, so let's get to it. Today, news out of City Hall that the mayor's making some tweaks to his CPS requirement to have post-high school plans. It's college or trade school. He announced that initiative last year to mixed reviews. Today, he recognized that there aren't enough guidance counselors in the system to support kids looking to go to college. So the city colleges are lending a hand, providing counselors to help with his mandate. This is interesting. I mean, this comes at a time where the mayor has doubled down on trying to break through with Chicago's youth and help decrease youth unemployment. He's really into this, and he continues, whether it's the summer jobs or what he's doing now. And he was on hand a month or so ago to introduce Beyond the Diploma, a new program for our friends at Skills for Chicagoland's Future. It pairs up youth with counselors and corporate partners like Walgreens to help kids get ready for life after school, to help them join the workforce. And reading all of this recent news pushed by the mayor, it makes me wonder if we need to start thinking differently about getting young people ready for work. Does society need a sea change in this area? At one point, you were considered an adult once you were 18 years old, and it was up to you to chart your course. But as trends change, it's important for us to reexamine that and adjust support and resources available for collegiate years and beyond. That's what we're talking about tonight. Joining me in studio, Tiana Carter. She's the Vice President of Business Development and Innovation at Skills for Chicagoland's Future. Tiana, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So just to refresh the memories of our listeners, because we've talked with you guys before, what does Skills do?
Yeah, so Skills for Chicagoland's Future, we are a nonprofit focused on partnering with businesses here in the Chicagoland area to fill their unmet hiring needs and connect them with under and unemployed talent throughout the city.
I remember the last conversation we had, we talked about how that was getting CEOs and businesses out of their comfort zone and trying different circles and trying to really think about getting employees from other places. Not necessarily about youth. Where does youth come in this case? And let's talk about Beyond the Diploma.
Yeah, interestingly enough, a few years ago, we did some research and realized about 40% of our placements were youth. And we're categorizing youth in this instance as 18 to 24-year-olds. And we realized through, you know, a tremendous amount of research we did internally, we had conversations with youth to understand their challenges, employers to understand what challenges they had with hiring youth and retaining youth, as well as community partners, and found that youth typically have 5 to 7 percentage points lower retention than adult workers. And so intrigued by that, we wanted to dig in and find out why. And through our research and conversations with many partners, we connected the dots that there's this lack of exposure nowadays. You know, in many instances in the high school setting or in the school setting, the focus is so heavily focused on college, it's crowding out conversations around employment. And so through those conversations and understanding that, we dug a little bit deeper, and then we designed this comprehensive program to address some of the challenges that are holding individuals back.
Well, and let's talk about that, because, you know, even today it was brought up again about the mayor's mandate to have postgraduate plans for CPS students. And that's great. And he talked about it very eloquently about charting a course and making a plan for your future. You're not just done with school and it's time to, and talk about how your plan with beyond the diploma and that plan merge together, because they seem in a way to be a little bit of contrast, but talk about how they work together.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this program, I would say, is pretty complementary. You know, when you look at statistics where 39% of African-American youth in Chicagoland are out of school and out of work, and the same is pretty similar for Hispanic youth at 30% being unemployed and disconnected. This program fits perfectly because it covers the areas that they need support. So it brings in a few different factors. You have employers who are providing the job opportunities and career pathways. We're partnering with City Colleges as well, who's bringing the education component. Additionally, we're partnering with community partners who are providing mentoring services to help with those life issues, the challenges that hold young adults back, whether that be transportation or childcare or youth homelessness, which is a huge challenge here in the city as well. And so this program brings all of those facets together to really allow these individuals to move along over the course of 2 years and be successful and have supports along the way.
I love talking to you guys, because last year when we were talking about this is really in the backdrop of the city's initiative to get summer jobs for kids. And there's so much been made, and you continue to hear it when you talk about Chicago's inequality, and you talk about poverty, and you talk about violence, and how, you know, it's not a criminal justice issue, it's a social issue, or it's an issue where we need to provide more opportunities. And places like Skills are doing that. How difficult is it to get youth employed? Meaning, you know, we talked about this with Marie last time, but the concept of yeah, you can say there's going to be jobs for kids, but are the kids actually going to want to get them?
Absolutely. I mean, again, we placed over 400 youth last year, and there's overwhelmingly more individuals out there who want opportunities. And the biggest factor that we see in many instances is this opportunity and access gap, right? When you think about how you or I will go about finding a job opportunity, about 75% of jobs are found through networking. Well, if you are a young adult living on the south side of Chicago or the west side or you know, a different area of the city, and your neighbor is not someone who can get your resume to the top of the pile, you're kind of lost in the shuffle. Many instances when we talk to the candidates that we work with, they have applied to these employers, but because no one knows who they are, and they're mm-hmm. kind of getting lost in their applicant tracking systems, they're not getting moved up, and they're not getting selected for conversations. And so we have a team of recruiters back at our office who spend time understanding those stories and partnering with businesses and advocating for those individuals and those youth in particular, and tell their stories and to connect them with jobs.
I want to single out Walgreens, because they're a big partner in Beyond the Diploma. Talk about how you get them to the table. I mean, to say this is important and we want to make sure that youth are employed, and we hope that it comes through your company. How do you get a big company, a big corporation like Walgreens, to show interest in this?
You find out what the business need is. What are you trying to solve? When you think about a Walgreens who has a huge footprint in the Chicagoland area and across the country in many cases, they have the unique ability to meet people where they're at. They are in the neighborhoods where these individuals need job opportunities. And furthermore, here in Chicago, they have a corporate headquarters. And so imagine if you're a youth and you can get an opportunity at the entry level coming in at Walgreens as a customer service associate or a pharmacy tech, and you have a mapped out 2-year plan to move along a career, move into store leadership or move into a corporate position, coupled with getting a college degree, not only are you going to have this commitment to Walgreens and the brand, but you're going to share that with everyone you know, right? You're going to be the best brand ambassador of that organization. And so when you think about unique ways employers are also starting to look at broadening their footprint and bringing in new, adding new customers, this also is a way to connect to young adults and the next generation of individuals and help their brands grow.
To Tiana Carter's in studio. She's the Vice President of Business Development and Innovation at Skills for Chicagoland's Future. We're talking about youth unemployment, but also beyond the diploma, their new program. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. And I want to ask you about, you know, this concept of, do we have to start thinking differently about how we approach youth employment? Used to be you're 18 years old, you're on your own. But now, it became, you know, you get a college degree, you're going to get a job. All those things seem to be out the window when it comes to the new youth that are coming up right now that are looking for work. Tiana Carter in studio. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. Yeah, that tuition story is interesting. Rob will have that at 8 o'clock. It kind of ties into what we're talking about today. We're talking about youth unemployment, but we're also talking about the idea of whether or not society has to rethink their position, our position together, when it comes to college and the American dream, and whether or not it's worth it for a lot of these kids to go in for four-year colleges, put all that money down when it's not guaranteed that they're going to find work, that they're going to be employed. In studio with me, Tiana Carter. She's the Vice President of Business Development and Innovation at Skills for Chicagoland's Future. They are the one behind the program Beyond the Diploma. They're talking about addressing youth unemployment. But this is a little bit more this is a lofty part of the conversation, just more about how do you convince kids who are 18 years old to go to college, finish college, when it's not guaranteed at the end that there's going to be a place for them in the workforce?
You know, it's interesting you say that. You know, college is not the silver bullet anymore, right? And the unique thing and the great thing about this particular program is these employers, you know, that we have at the table, we have Walgreens, Rush University Medical Center, Freeman Manufacturing, CDW, they are all investing in actually funding portions of the education, if not the entire degree. And so not only are these individuals leaving with a career and a career pathway, no less, but they also are advancing their education in the process.
So that's really what you see, like a private company being able to essentially subsidize education while they work already.
Absolutely.
That's the idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I wonder about it, because obviously what we're talking about, youth unemployment, is the mayor has targeted this, and this has been something that, you know, if the kids are employed, then they're not doing something else. And Chicago has an issue right now with a lot of unemployment, which, as you mentioned, 39% in the African-American community, 30% in the Hispanic community. And you question the idea that if you can get to the kids and get them work and get them on the path to careers and otherwise and find incentives to make them think about their futures, they'd be less inclined to think about the short term now and do things they're not supposed to.
No, absolutely. When you think about, you know, what's the new phrase, right? Nothing stops a bullet like a job. This program in particular is doing just that. It is connecting individuals with job opportunities and a career pathway. And sometimes that's just not enough. And we know that, right? A lot of times the reasons youth quit employment, right? They may secure a job opportunity and then quit after a year or drop out, is because they want work to feel like family. They don't want to feel disposable. And so these employers are truly coming to the table and wrapping their arms around youth. In addition, we have brought partners to the table, like Chicago Urban League, 1 Million Degrees, the CARE program, to provide external mentoring to help with those life issues, because we bring our whole selves to work. We're not just kind of these robots who come in and do our job. And so this program really allows the whole individual to be supported.
That is interesting about the idea of disposable work. And if you feel disposable, you'll find you find yourself likely to dispose of the job. I continue to come back to this because I strongly believe that employment opportunities, as you just said, even that old adage that nothing stops a bullet like a job, it does mean something. And the city seems to be doubling down, and a lot of not-for-profits who come in the studio and talk are also moving. How, at the end of the day, though, in all reality, how do you get a kid to buy into this? How do you get a kid who maybe already have a life where they're making money on the black market, or have decided they found their family in gangs and other places? How do you get them to recognize a path that they may not have ever been shown before?
Absolutely. So, you know, Arnie Duncan's doing a lot of work in this space through Emerson Collective and in the Chicago CRED program.
Yeah.
And through his research, I think, he said about $12 an hour is the ticket, right? And these jobs kind of match exactly what that, you know, person on the street is making when you kind of break down the economics behind it. And so, it's being honest and having conversations with the youth about, you know, where is that life leading and what the other options are out there. Because if you don't know the options available, then how do you pursue them? And so, you know, the neat thing is the Walgreens programs, it's launching. We're in the recruitment process. Applications are open on the skills website, scfjobs.com. If you know a youth or an individual, or you are an individual who is looking for an opportunity, like this is the ticket.
Yeah.
It's not something that comes along every day that has so many different supports and elements to help you be successful.
One of the, and this will be my last question, but just one of the criticisms of the mayor's plans to essentially have graduation requirements for CPS students to go to college is that a lot of kids are going to go for a year, maybe for in a semester, and they're going to drop out. And that you've seen that more and more with kids in Chicago and other places where college isn't a four-year adventure anymore. What needs to be done to change that? Does there need to be more counselors? Does there need to be more resources provided? Does there need to be more support for freshmen, for 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, instead of 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds?
I think all of those things, and it depends on the individual. The big thing is celebrating the short-term wins. When you feel like your success is 4 years away, that's when it's challenging. That's when it's hard to digest and you feel like you're in the trenches. But when you have a program that you have the job and you're being promoted every few months and you see the opportunity and you're in school at the same time and you're able to get a certificate or a degree within kind of a two-year span, you start to feel like you are accomplishing something. And so this program allows the individuals and the young adults to feel empowered and feel like they are making an impact on their own lives and being contributors to the organizations that they're working for. And so this hopefully combats that, and the fingers crossed that we'll have some great retention numbers at the two-year mark.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to having you guys back. Tiana Carter is the Vice President of Business Development and Innovation at Skills for Chicagoland's Future. Tiana, thanks for being here. Appreciate it. Thank you, Rob. It is the download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, Aziz Alaka is going to join us from Alaka Films. He is a music video director for local Chicago hip-hop artists. It is fascinating. His work is so prolific. Hundreds and hundreds of videos by some of the stars today. Millions and millions of views. I mean, it is astounding.
Wow.
This kid has done a tremendous, tremendous job in such a short amount of career. We'll talk to him about being the video soundtrack for the drill scene here in Chicago, Chicago hip hop. Also, the senior writers over at Clickhole, the video arm of The Onion, will be with us to talk about their new project with a new fake senator. They're working on it. It's a really fun stuff. So we'll talk with them coming up in the 9 o'clock hour and at 10 o'clock tonight, swap meet. My next guest is a playwright who just recently opened up his own theater company. Dan Noonan has been writing plays for years now, and a Chicago playwright got together with creative partner Sarah Whitney to open up a new theater company called Spot On, the Spot On Company. Not an easy feat by any stretch.
No.
Their first play up is a world premiere, Noonan's new work, Blue Over You. It's a play written by Dan that is a mysterious one-man love story with musical bits. There you go. It's playing at the Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston through January 28th. Dan's work as a playwright somewhat mirrors his life. Many of his plays and his characters deal with health issues and the complications they create and how they overcome. And that makes sense because at a young age, Dan's life was presented with real life and death drama. He's a hemophiliac, and when he was 13, Dan was given a blood transfusion. Unbeknownst to doctors at the time, the blood was tainted, and Dan, again, at the age of 13, became HIV positive. His story became a national one as the world came to grips with the deadly disease and how it could be spread through blood. And because of cases like Dan's, blood banks changed their policies and procedures. Many of the men and women and children that were affected by this, by the HIV-tainted blood, are no longer with us. But Dan Noonan, who just turned 50, is very much alive and has dedicated his artistic life to writing his story. Dan Noonan, my guest tonight at the big table. Dan, thanks for being here. Good to see you, bud.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
All right, so first let's talk about this. You want to start a theater company? Like, where are you at in your life that you're like, you know what, I want to start a theater company? That usually is the exploits of a young kid out of college, a 20-year-old. He's like, I'm going to change the world. Yeah. Why Spot On?
Well, probably because I just turned 50 and I was having a midlife crisis and I figured I got to do something to shake things up. I mean, I'm 50 years old. So, yeah, I was working with my creative partner, Sarah Whitney, who's an outstanding director. And we had been working on this script, Blue Over You, for years. We started in about 2008. We had workshops. We had public readings, lots of rewrites. And we were really excited about where we got the script. So I sent this script out to a bunch of festivals and contests. It did real well. It had a standing ovation at the Dayton Playhouse Future Fest, and I thought, okay, this is when I really got to make sure it gets up. I felt really good about it. But we shopped it around to the theaters in Chicago that we had relationships with, and we didn't have a bite, so we decided, you know what?
Why not do it ourselves?
Right. Life is too short. It's time to do this. So we decided to start our own theater company. And then Blue Over You would be the first show that we produced.
It's amazing because your work, I mean, this is a one-man show.
Yes.
And your work has been a nice mix of drama and comedy, and you've done a lot of different things in your life. As any mission statement for a theater company comes out when you started, what kind of plays are you creating, and what does Spot On want to bring the audiences of Chicago?
Well, I usually use comedy as a tool when I'm writing my plays. I mean, it's a nice way to bring an audience in, make them feel relaxed, comfortable, engaged with the character. And then often it goes beyond the comedy and deals with issues that almost everybody deals with, which is health complications or disability. I mean, those are things I'm passionate about, so they're in all of my work. And they're in Blue Over You. And it's a mystery, so I can't give too much away. But it does address an issue that millions of Americans deal with. And it was just time to get the show up. So we decided to form a company.
You've had a lot of success with stage readings. I've always known you to be someone who you'll go to a festival, or you'll enter a competition, or you'll do the stage reading. And a lot of times, I would assume, just from knowing how that process works, that doesn't necessarily guarantee that a play is going to be produced. So having your own theater company at this point almost gives you that guarantee that the work that you get high accolades for on stage for the stage reading will be produced.
Right. I mean, there's a thing with playwrights nowadays, they call it development hell, where there's just lots of attention on stage readings for new works, workshops. But it's really hard to get that production. It's understandable because doing new work is risky for everybody, particularly for a theater company. And so we decided that we were willing to take that risk. And we were hoping that we could find an audience that was willing to take that risk with us. And the response to this play has been overwhelmingly positive. We're really glad that we did it. And we just wanted to have that control. We were able to cast the actor we wanted to cast, Sarah and I, my collaborator. He's a wonderful actor, Michael Joseph Mitchell. He's an Equity actor, works constantly in Chicago.
Yeah, he's well known, yeah.
Yeah, and so we were really, that was something that we knew we could do. Since we were producing it, we could choose the actor we wanted.
Do you like it? Do you like the power that comes with the ability to produce your own plays?
But that's why we write plays.
As a playwright, I mean, there's a lot of playwrights that are like, well, I like to hand it over, and then there's the directors and producers in the theater company that will do the work, and I stay out of it, or I get in wherever I need to be. But for you, do you like the idea that you're also the second arm of the process when the play's done?
I really enjoy the collaboration. I mean, theater is a collaborative art, so I really like to work with the director, with the designers, with the casting director. I'm glad I'm not doing all of that on my own. I really want the expertise of other people, but if you work well together, it's just a joy. And so when I was working with Sarah and some of the designers who we've worked with before, it's just been a real pleasure. And like I said, being involved in casting, where other plays that have gone up, I haven't had an input in the casting at all. I was really glad to have that.
Have you been in positions as a playwright where you're like, interesting choice?
Yes, I have, actually. Within stage readings and productions, yes, I've come across some interesting choices. But that's part of the deal.
Right.
when you put your work out there, you have to give it up a little bit and see what happens.
Playwright Dan Noonan in studio tonight. His new show, Blue Over You, is at, it's a mysterious one-man love story with musical bits. Don't leave out the musical bits. It's playing at the Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston through January 28th. It's part of his new theater company, Spot On. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and let's catch up. I mean, I know your story pretty well because we've talked about it before and we're friends. And,
right.
And, but I think letting the audience in on the life you've lived and the health issues and complications you've had in your life is something we'll explore coming up here on The Download. Dan Noonan at the big table. Stay with us. It's Download here, 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here with playwright Dan Noonan. He's my guest at the big table. His new show, Blue Over You, is at the Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston, running through January 28th. It is a play written by Dan and put on by his new theater company, which he shares with Sarah Whitney, called Spot On, Spot On Company. Dan Noonan, I've been pitching it all day that you're coming in studio. And first of all, you know, happy birthday. I mean, you just
Thank
turned you. 50.
Yep.
But there was a time in your life where 50 was unimaginable.
Yes.
Let's start there. I mean, to think about, I've known you for 20 plus years, and to think that, you know, even in that time, it's been up and down for you. But let's go back to when you were a kid.
Yeah, well, it starts when I was about a year old and was first diagnosed with hemophilia back in 1969. Back then, there weren't a lot of great treatments for hemophiliacs, so my parents were told by doctors, well, life expectancy could be 9-10 years old, and wow. So they had to deal with that. And then a couple years later, they came up with some medicine, a blood product called Factor VIII, which is what hemophiliacs need to clot their blood.
So that's really what hemophilia is, the fact that you can't clot, blood can't clot, right?
Right, but external cuts, things like that, are not really a problem with Factor VIII, and there are different factors, there are different types of bleeding disorders, but with the most common, hemophilia, which I have, you're missing Factor VIII, and most of the bleeds occur in your joints, in your elbows, your knees, your ankles, so when you use them, everybody... they can have blood vessels that break, but your clotting system works and mine doesn't. So I have to take a blood transfusion. I don't anymore. Now it's just a synthetic medicine, which is phenomenal. But when I was a kid, they were blood transfusions where part of the blood was taken out, Factor VIII, mixed with sterile water, and I would give myself an intravenous shot. And so,
not unlike a diabetic in whatever right. form that you would have to do that regularly.
Regularly, exactly. That's exactly right. So I had a pretty happy childhood. I mean, my parents really gave me a lot of love and attention, and it was great. But then in the early 1980s, the blood supply became contaminated with HIV. And every time I received a blood transfusion, I was probably being exposed to about 1,000 people. So you can, of their blood that they donated at blood drive. So you can imagine, if you're exposed to that many people and HIV in the blood supply, eventually you're going to be exposed to HIV.
Yeah.
So at first, they started to tell the hemophilia community, you've probably been exposed. We don't know what that means. They hadn't even isolated the HIV virus yet, but they just let us know that there was a good chance that we were exposed to it. But they said, try not to worry. So 13, 14, 15, tried not to think about it too much. Tried not to get too worried. But then as the whole HIV/AIDS story continued, obviously people became very sick. And
it became a big story on the right. news, where they were talking about the blood banks and we're talking about the blood supply, things right. like that. So yeah, it became something that entered your living room nightly.
Right, right. Yeah, my mom used to throw out magazines when they had cover stories on HIV/AIDS, afraid that I would read it and become upset by it. But I would say in the mid to late 80s, when everybody was getting sick and dying, that's when it really hit home to me that I probably didn't have a lot of time left. It just seemed that eventually everybody who was HIV positive developed AIDS. And
so was there a time, I mean, because we know the story that people would go get tested and they would be diagnosed. Were you diagnosed with HIV, or was it a grand thing where they said, hey, listen, everybody who was doing this is probably exposed to it?
What they did, which is interesting, is that my hematologist, as soon as the HIV epidemic came to pass, he took blood samples and he froze them. So once they isolated whatever this virus was, he could go back and test everything. And so he gave a very specific date, like, this was the last time you were HIV negative. And then by, I think it was summer of 1981, you became HIV positive. So as soon as they isolated the virus, that's when they tested all our blood, and then they told us, you're HIV positive. And that was probably around 1985, 86.
As a young boy, I mean, 13, 14, 15 years old, take us back to your thoughts and emotions around this, because that was a craze. There was hysteria, of course,
and
the gay community was losing people left and right. I mean, what was your emotional reaction to the fact that you were HIV positive?
Well, I think I had one thing going for me, that I had already been dealing with a chronic health condition my whole life. So I tried to kind of incorporate that into my worldview, that this is something new. We don't know for sure. But as the AIDS epidemic went on and everybody was dying, I really thought, oh, maybe I'll be 20, 25 at max. But, you know, my family was very loving and supportive, so they just kind of focused on making sure I had a really great time. They showered me with a lot of love and attention and good times, and that's sort of what we did to combat, you know, the sadness of the whole situation.
Have you talked to your parents about their emotion in that regard, like learning about this and being in a position where you became HIV positive? And of course, you, from your angle, you recognize what they've done, but have you ever had a chance? Did you ever have a chance? I don't know, you know.
We have talked about it. I mean, they tried to put on a positive face for me, obviously, but they definitely thought that I wouldn't be around forever. So, I mean, I worked hard at school and did well, but they always made sure that I enjoyed my friends, that we took trips, but they would talk about, you know, if I became really sick, starting hospice and making sure I didn't suffer too much. I mean, those were thoughts that were going through their mind, which, as I'm a parent now, seems unbelievable to have to think about how hard that is. There are a lot of people who are dealing with that right now, and my empathy goes out to them. So once they came out with protease inhibitors, which were this cocktail that saved so many people's lives and continues to save people's lives, my parents kind of opened up and were like, phew, we were so worried for so many years. We were desperate. We just didn't want to bring you down. We wanted you to have as many opportunities and life experiences as you possibly could. So, yeah. And then when I got married, my mom one night kind of sat me down and was just reminiscing about everything that was going through her mind as I was growing up. And she kept all that from me when I was growing up, but obviously those thoughts were there for her.
When you get to the point of your life where you become an adult, 21, 22, as you mentioned, and the years keep going by, and you have to reconcile the fact that you didn't think you'd be around, were you living a short-term life? Were you thinking, well, I've got a year, I've got two, well, maybe 5 years, I'm getting better, 10 years up, back to a year? Like, I mean, How do you mentally prepare yourself as an adult when time is up?
Yeah, I definitely took the short-term view. I thought about some long-term goals. I was in law school for a week and decided that this is not for me right now. I'm not going to spend my time doing this. I mean, being a lawyer is a wonderful profession, but I would have been a very mediocre lawyer, and I thought there are enough mediocre lawyers in the world. They don't need me.
You could have had your own commercial.
That's true. So I went and got my master's in theater at Northwestern. Not necessarily the most practical thing to do, but because I was thinking, I got to live in the now. I want to do what I'm passionate about and what I enjoy. So I went to Northwestern and got my master's in theater, and I loved it, and it was a wonderful experience. But if I hadn't been HIV positive, I don't know if I would have done that. I might have continued with law school and thought, oh, I'll pursue theater later on down the line. Yeah. But I was like, nope, I got to do it now.
I'm interested, and we'll take a break here because I want to get keep on time and get the news with Rob. But when we come back, I want to talk about how difficult or how challenging it was for you as an artist when you go to school for theater to be in a position where you want to tell your story. Because a lot of theater and a lot of art is about escapism, right?
Right.
This idea that you can write fantastical stories about unicorns and period pieces.
Right.
But in your case, you have stuck to a script that is prolific, but at the same time deals with characters with health complications and overcoming those complications. A lot of close mirrored kind of stuff to what you've gone through. Dan Noonan, my guest, he is a playwright here in Chicago. We're talking about his life, hemophiliac, who contracted HIV in the early 80s when he was a young boy at 13 years old from a blood transfusion. We'll talk more with Dan Noonan coming up here. His play, which is on stage right now at Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston, is called Blue Over You. It's running through January 28th. We'll take a quick break. More with Dan Noonan. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's the Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight at the big table, Dan Noonan, playwright here in Chicago. His new play is on stage at the Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston, running through January 28th, called Blue Over You. You can get tickets at blueoveryou.com. Dan, a longtime playwright in town, finally stepped up and made his own theater company, Spot On Theater Company, with his creative partner, Sarah Whitney. We're talking about how a lot of your plays over the years have had to deal with characters with health complications and how they overcome them, right?
Right.
I mean, that's a mirror to what we were talking about before the break about your experience being diagnosed with hemophilia at a young age, at the age of one,
right?
In the late 60s and all through the 70s, and then in the early 80s, having a blood transfusion with tainted blood, which you contracted HIV.
Right, right.
And life since that time has been one of not sure what's next.
It's true.
Really? Really, when you think about it, it's obviously we think about that disease and we think about, oh my, the virus and just how it was just decimated people and it struck so at the heart of our society. But the other part of it, too, is this emotion of having to live with it and not knowing when the end is coming.
It's true.
How do you use that in your art?
I think it's why I got into theater and art, is I had a lot of strong feelings and I wanted a way to express them. I took a directing class at Boston College as an undergraduate, and the professor was a wonderful man. And he would introduce my scenes and say, and now another play by Dan Noonan about death. So I would always direct these scenes, you know, Long Day's Journey in Tonight, The Shadow Box, things that just dealt with death. And two of the favorite things I was in at Boston College were Tracers, which is about Vietnam and the horrors of Vietnam, and Mother Courage and Her Children, which is about the horrors of war. I was definitely drawn to those types of plays and parts. And what's funny is when I started to write on my own, though, I wrote with a lot of comedy. And I think I got that from my parents, who were like, you know what? Try and find the silver lining. Like, this is an absurd situation you're in. It's really hard, but there are some funny things that happen along the way.
Silver linings is a big part of your work.
I mean, yes.
I mean, whatever character, from whether it's Out Among the Dragons or Setup or any of the Blind Date show.
Right.
I forgot the name of the
Blind Date. No, it was called Setup.
That's Setup.
Yes.
And but a lot of it has to do with silver linings. The idea that you might have a character with dire health complications, but the twist and the reason that the play exists is about finding and harnessing that silver lining.
Yeah, my play Setup is about a type 1 diabetic and a man who's struggling with severe depression go out on a blind date. Now, they obviously don't know that the other person is struggling with these health conditions when they meet, but over the course of the evening, they open up about their lives and you discover that they have these challenges. And by the end of the play, it's a romantic comedy. You could be thinking, oh, they're going to get together. I can just see it coming. Like, they're going to be happy in the end. And the type 1 diabetic says, you know, you're a great guy. I really enjoy you. But I am going off and doing this mission work in Haiti. That's something that she'd been planning all along. And when her love life wasn't going the way she wanted it to, she said, you know what? I'm going to put that on hold and I'm going to do this. And at the end of the play, she goes off and does her volunteer work. And they decide to spend the 2 or 3 weeks before she goes together. So it's not a happily ever after where they get married. It's more realistic than that.
You found another twist on death, right? It may not be death as we know it, but this relationship has a has an expiration date.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, I've known you for a long time, Dan, and it is interesting because, as we mentioned right before the news, you know, you could easily find escapism in theater. You could, for the life that you've lived, and I mean, the life, it's so wrought with emotion, and even with your relationships and your family, I mean, all of that without sort of a constant at the end to know if you're going to live.
Right.
You would think that you would embrace the idea of escapism, something else to not think about it. What do you think it is? And talk about the challenge of embracing all of those fears, those insecurities, and all the things that go into not knowing what's next and flowing it through art.
Well, it's just a real motivator. It's a motivator to express what you have come to understand about life. And I tend to often do it with humor, which is really just a coping mechanism. I mean, it's something you develop when you're facing challenges. You find humor in the little things. And I just became passionate about not only writing about my specific conditions and health issues, but those of my friends, those of my family. I mean, I am always drawn to people who have chronic health conditions. I think they're really interesting people. I think they've got an interesting perspective on life. So Out Among the Dragons was directly on my experience. I mean, the main character, Patrick, wasn't me entirely, but a lot of him was based on me. But after I wrote that, I wanted to expand into other conditions, other problems. And
As one does.
And that's what I did with Blue Over You as well. I just thought that the issues that this main character experiences are important and interesting, and I think people will find it fascinating.
For you, as a theater artist at Boston College, but also Northwestern and other places, and even as a playwright working with collaborators and other artists, when it's one thing to find a passion or a storyline that you want to pursue, death, as you mentioned. You're always Dan Noonan with another play about death. Right. And there's another to say, oh, I'm intrigued by chronic conditions. But it's altogether another thing to look at your own situation and the mortality and everything that goes into it and write from that. And you kind of did that with Out Among the Dragons.
Yes.
What did it take to get there? Were you talking about those other issues, death and chronic conditions, because you didn't want to talk about your own? And what did it take to tell your own story?
Well, I put a hemophiliac at the center of that story, so I didn't have to do much research. I had it within me. But, you know, the thing about HIV and AIDS is, to me, the biggest problem is the stigma, that there's a stigma attached to it. So people don't want to go and get tested. They don't want to know that they're HIV positive, feeling that they have some explaining to do if they do become HIV positive.
Right.
So HIV was, in another way, an extension of what I had already been going through as a hemophiliac. I mean, another chronic health condition that you had to watch, take care of, but always try and move forward. But the more I read about HIV/AIDS and it was in the media and I was exposed to a lot of different opinions and thoughts, I didn't write just my experience. I included a gay character and a character who was an IV drug user in Out Among the Dragons. And although I did write a lot about my own experience, it was the idea of the stigma that I was fascinated by. Because people that you love, you never think that they should be disposable or suffer because of their sex life or because of substance abuse. I mean, it just doesn't matter to you when it's personal. But nationally, in the culture, sometimes people were saying, well, these people got themselves into this own situation, so they should have to pay the penalty.
Oh my God, that was the underlying story and the judgment in this country when it came to HIV and AIDS,
right?
Which was the part where being a hemophiliac and having a blood transfusion and being caught up in the middle of that. I can't even imagine.
Well, it was, you know, there was a time of Ryan White as well, who was a young boy who lived in Indiana, and he was not able to go to school for a period of time because he was HIV positive. And I often wondered if my friends, my peers, were aware of that in the news, because everybody knew that I had hemophilia, but I didn't know if they automatically knew that I was HIV positive. And I've always tried to be very open about it. I think that was healthy for me and healthy for the cause in general. But I didn't talk about it all the time.
Right.
And, you know, there were definitely some bumps along the way when people were surprised that I was HIV positive and how close they wanted to be to me. Things like that were an issue as well. So,
and I would assume compounded upon the fact that you're a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, being a teenager, like, I mean, I can understand, like, having HIV positive as an adult, you're HIV, you have to deal with all those kind of things. But as a teenager, to feel that from other people before you've evolved and matured around, you know, issues of intimacy and love and all that kind of stuff, it must have been double hard.
Yeah, it was totally hard. I mean, I never thought I would have a sex life. I just thought, well, this just isn't going to happen to me. And when I wrote that play, Out Among the Dragons, that was sort of the main focus I had for that character, that he desperately wanted to have that experience of having a sex life. So he kind of goes to his infectious disease clinic and sees if there are any attractive girls around his age that he might be able to ask out. I mean, but those are the types of things that go through your head when you're a teenager and you're HIV positive and you're thinking, will I ever have these experiences? Probably not. So, again, it was a real motivator for me to write a play about it.
You know, I'm talking a lot about your history. You know,
yes.
And you've got a new play, and it's not necessarily about hemophilia, or, I mean, it's about health complications in some form. It's a mystery, so we don't want to give it away.
But,
you know, as you move forward as an artist and you continue to explore different topics, do you find yourself drifting away from that huge part of your life, a life that has given you a chronic disease of hemophilia and on top of it HIV positive? I mean, do you find yourself drifting, or is that your center? Are you always thinking about that when creating and writing?
I think it's made me attuned to the struggles that other people go through and kind of then fascinated by them. So I would say that I am drifting away from the hemophilia and the HIV positive as far as my artistic work. And it's really interesting to put myself in other people's shoes who are struggling with other chronic health conditions, like the character who has diabetes. I mean, I have a good friend who has diabetes, and it's really rough. I mean, she's got to be monitoring herself constantly. You have to be vigilant all the time. And that's not something I dealt with, but I could see how hard and challenging and exhausting that can be. And I thought, I want to write a character who talks about that and is experiencing that. I have another friend who has muscular dystrophy, and he's kind of in my head. I want to write a play about him soon. He doesn't know it, so hopefully he's listening tonight. Mike, I'm going to write a play about you.
Mike, it's on.
It's time,
Mike.
So I am drifting a little bit away from the HIV and the hemophilia because I've looked at my story pretty in depth. I've written about it, and now I want to help tell other people's stories.
You know, we'll finish where we started. I mean, one of the first questions I asked and when we started talking about your story was, you're just turned 50 years old.
Yep.
And now that we've kind of gone through the story all this hour, you know, 50 was never promised. It never was. And, you know, for you to be 13, 14, 15 years old, looking in the short term, within a decade of a lifespan, to be at 50 years old, have your own family, to have a career and continue to be able to have artistic contributions to society, to the world, to Chicago. What's it mean to you to be here right now in the studio talking about this?
Oh, I feel incredibly blessed. I mean, actually, there's a little bit of survivor's guilt as well. I've told people I knew three other guys who had hemophilia who were named Dan, and they all had Irish last names as well. So there were four of us, and I'm the only one who's still alive. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I continue to want to tell stories about people's struggles, because I've known a lot of people who weren't as fortunate as I was. I'm still here, and I can still help tell other people's stories. So I'm kind of passionate about doing that.
Dan Noonan, playwright here in Chicago, just started his own theater company called Spot On. The play, the first one, a world premiere. It's called Blue Over You. It's a mysterious one-man love story with musical bits. It's at the Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston, running through January 28th. You can get tickets at blueoveryou.com. Dan, great to see you.
Great to see you,
and
Justin.
Thank you so much for sharing your story tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, don't say that. I fall into that category.
Yeah, don't kill the messenger.
Yeah. Oh, that's a must-listen-to newscast. And finances are on the line. Good combo with Dan Noonan, huh? Wow. Ryan White. I mean, that was a huge deal. The kids who contracted HIV from blood transfusions in the 80s, and that was just such a... Just a terrible story that just became, remember, that almost became a bigger story, and maybe rightfully so, than the actual epidemic itself. There wasn't as much in mainstream media love for the people who were actually dying from this disease. Mainstream media, I mean, I'm talking about like on the news, you know. But when you start bringing in 13-year-old kids from Indiana who... you know, I have to do blood transfusions. Then that was like Dan Rather was all over that. Like,
and Elton John.
And Elton John, right? Yeah, but it's hard to fathom, you know, a life when you're 13 years old and you're essentially, like you said, there are four Dans with Irish names and he's the only one left. But also Dan gets a chance to live his life, be 50 years old, just to celebrate his 50th birthday, which says a lot about where we've come when it comes to treatment and drugs and drug regimens to be able to keep people alive and have it be a chronic health condition as opposed to a death sentence. But go see Dan's plays. They're always good. And, I mean, I think a lot of people out there can identify having chronic health conditions. Anyway, coming up here, I'm excited. We're going to talk with the writers from Clickhole, the Onion's video arm, viral video arm. I love that they already tell you it's viral before it comes out. It's great. We'll talk about their amazing new campaign. They are equal opportunity offenders when it comes to parodies of both sides of the aisle when it comes to politics. So we'll talk with Clickhole writers come up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then Aziz Alaka from Laka Films will be here, a music video director for Chicago hip-hop artists in the drill scene. Some big names. Soulja Boy, Lil Bibby, G Herbo, Famous Drex, a lot of people who are very, very popular in underground hip hop. You look at his YouTube channel and you're getting 8 to 10 million views on DIY rap videos of clowning around in front of the Chick-fil-A on Chicago. I love it. Talk to him coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. Thank you, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, Greg Flamm is back for another edition of the Swap Meet. This is, of course, where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. You give us a call. We'll tell you what it's worth. It's a lot of fun. I am still holding out hope that my Yo MTV Raps t-shirt that I bought at the mall in Florida, in Tampa, back in, I would say, early 90s, like really early 90s, is accumulating value. Like, I feel like every time we do the swap meet, I feel like each week this could be the week that he could check back in, and then now everybody wants the Yo MTV Raps shirt. You know, like, because I asked him like maybe a month ago, and he's like, it's worth nothing. But I feel like if I keep staying on it, maybe continue to talk about it, that there will become value, will become attached to that dingy, somewhat used t-shirt, right? So we'll see how that goes. Also, Aziz Alaka from Laka Films will join us to talk about hip-hop artists in Chicago. He's a music video film director. That's coming up in the 9:30 segment. Well, I'm embarrassed to say this, but my next guests are making their debut appearance on The Download. Why? Because Clickhole, the famed internet parody arm of The Onion, is relevant all the time and should have a presence in all of our lives always. Clickhole has been creating shareable content that's essentially making fun of shareable content. For a couple years now, it's a parody of digital news sites like BuzzFeed and HuffPo. And their latest products are political, like this video with faux Senator Anita Hawkins.
I stand here before you as a woman, a mother, a senator, a Democrat. And on behalf of all Americans, I have this to say to my Republican colleagues. This speech is going to go very, very viral. If there is anything I have learned since this administration took power, it is that what's being recorded right now is going to spread across the internet like herpes in a whorehouse.
Go. That famed line. There you go. Senator Anita Hawkins from California? Sure. She comes complete with a Twitter handle and several already approved viral videos for you to share at your leisure. That's what Clickhole does. They make fun of our social media habits and our propensity to say this and then embed a video on our Facebook feed. They're equal opportunity mockers, parroting liberalism one day and right-wing media the next. In studio with me tonight, two of the writers from Clickhole, Lauren Moser and Noah Presswich. Noah, Lauren, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That's good. It's a pleasure. I'm a big fan of your site, always have been, and love the stuff that you're doing. I've gotten in, obviously, with Senator Hawkins here. You have sort of struck a nerve because we've seen more and more in the last year people sharing political content, political speeches that are on the House floor and the Senate floor. And the beauty of this is that it looks like a Senator Kamala Harris speech. Is that what you're going for here, to essentially, in a fun, positive way, trick people into thinking this is real?
Well, I think one thing like we try to like not do is like trick people so much, but like obviously has to look pretty real in order for the joke to pop. The main thing we want is for people to be laughing at these things and thinking they're very funny. But in order to do that, you have to make it look really good. So we have a really good production team who are able to sort of make these videos look like what you would see on like C-SPAN or whatever, that would then get sort of, you know, cropped and edited by the liberal site that would then like sort of put it on the internet
with
a thing on it. Yeah, and conservative sites do this as well. You know, they also have used the same tactics. So,
Lauren, do you have to be a student or astute observer of the way that both liberal and conservative websites do their job? I mean, do you have to constantly be reading different sides of the aisle to make the joke crisp?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we try to do every day. Like, we at Clickhole try to just parody the internet, and right now the internet has become very political. So just kind of naturally, when we log onto our Facebook pages or Twitter, that's just what pops up. So I personally don't really have to go out of my way to find these things, because they just kind of come to me. Right.
You're buried in it from the second you get online, you see. And obviously, like, everyone's sort of feed looks different. But I guess that's one thing that we do have to do, is that we have to sort of dip it outside of our feed in order to see, like, okay, what's going on in this other place? Because we have this other show, Patriot Hole, which is sort of a parody of the Alex Jones show that he has. Which is obviously, you know, completely different than what Anita Hawkins is doing.
But there is a value in the fact that you are finding a way to parody both sides of the aisle, because Patriot Hole is making fun of a very conservative type of media. But Anita Hawkins, and sharing the video the way that you did, that's a very liberal kind of way. How important is it to almost be equal opportunity offenders?
I mean, I just think it kind of happened naturally for us.
I mean, we weren't sort of like weighing the scales like, oh, we must be like both sides. We go with what's interesting to us and what we think is funny and what we think needs to be like is most like ripe for like a take from us, basically.
Yeah. And I think one thing that like we noticed was that on both sides of the aisle, these political figures, whether they're conservative or liberal, just like do want to become kind of viral media stars in their own right. They kind of have to. So if they're doing that, then we have to.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. I mean, more than ever, politicians are taking their time that they have at the pulpit or wherever they might be on the assembly floor. And they know that it's not just a compassionate speech or a passionate argument to their colleagues in the room, but they know they're being recorded. They know that this has got a possibility to be at Facebook. And that is so ripe for comedy.
Yeah. And you will see that on, like, you know, from both sides, from Republicans and Democrats. And, like, one thing I think we just noticed is that it was, like, especially in this sort of, like, this first year of Trump has been that media has especially become sort of very popular right now amongst people, amongst, like, liberals online.
Right.
And so it just felt like it's time for us to see if we can, like, say something about this. And you know, when we have a Anita give speeches or something, we're not, like, always, sometimes she's saying things that are clearly, like, making fun of, like, when this sort of, like, self-righteous like tone of voice that a lot of these speeches have, but other times, like, she's making a satirical point that's not a critique of the left. It can be a critique of the right, so right. We can make different kinds of critiques with this character, which,
Lauren,
is why
I mean the character is fun. I mean, anytime you get a chance to make from scratch a politician, because they are easy, that's ripe for parody. What do you have to put into it? The one thing I do like about Senator Hawkins, she has her own Twitter feed. Are there jokes specifically written for this character that are for the video, that are for just the Twitter feed, that are for maybe a Facebook page? Talk about how you construct the character of Senator Anita Hawkins.
Yeah, so we wanted Senator Hawkins' web presence to really mirror the web presence of a kind of, like, more liberal politician. So we built a Facebook page that we thought would include a lot of videos that would go viral on Facebook. So a lot of, like, impassioned addresses to the Senate and also videos where she's just kind of, like, sitting in her office and something big has just happened and she has to react to it immediately. And then her Twitter, we did similar stuff.
It's just trying to sort of, like, what's interesting about this character in writing the series, it's funny to think of it as a series because it's, like,
it's every day.
It's happening on all different kinds of platforms. Yes, and some of the things that we're writing are tweets and some of the things are longer videos and some of them are shorter videos, but we are sort of thinking of it as a series. But one thing that's funny about it is that these politicians have had to sort of become their own channels, which is, like, part of what, like, social media does to everyone. Like, celebrities all have become now their own, mm-hmm. like, sort of TV channels in a way that we sort of plug into when we go online. Like, I'll see what this person's up to. I'll see what they're up to. And so it's funny to see politicians do that and see how they have to, like, suddenly Elizabeth Warren has, like, you go to her page and you can watch hours of videos that she has produced. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, this is really interesting that these people are having to make their own. It's not just, like, campaign season and you see a campaign commercial for politicians.
Yeah, they're constantly
on. They're constantly online, constantly making media. So that's, like, that's been, like, an interesting thing.
Here's what we'll do. Let's take a quick break and I'll come back. And I want to talk about, you know, when you started Clickhole, which now I think is 2014, you know, it was about parroting internet habits, the way that we use the internet. And yeah. Over time, and even in the last, I would even say in the last 6 months, it changes all the time. How do you keep up with making sure that your parodies are on point when the social media habits of Americans and humans evolve at such a fast rate? In studio, Noah Presswich and Lauren Moser, they're both writers, senior writers at Clickhole. You can find it at clickhole.com. They are the internet parody arm of The Onion here in Chicago, based in Chicago. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, more conversation. Stay with us. It's a download here, 720 WGN, Noah Presswich and Lauren Moser, both writers at Clickhole, clickhole.com, the internet parody arm of The Onion. They created faux Senator Anita Hawkins from California, and they've also done Patriot Hole, which is a right-wing, a parody of the Alex Jones kind of conservative talk shows. They are in charge of essentially parodying our social media and internet habits. And it's funny because I said at the beginning, we were talking about it, I said it's a parody of digital news sites. And I said, like, BuzzFeed. And I mentioned to you guys before, Upworthy. Both of those sites, in a way, have changed. Upworthy, I don't even know if that's even doing what it was doing when it first started. But for to be a parody site that is making fun of the internet, I mean, you have to really be on top of what people are consuming, what their habits are, and how they're changing on any given day.
Yeah, it's very hard. You have to read a lot of things on the internet all the time. You get tired of the internet. Yeah, it's always a moving target, and it's weird.
And I mentioned Upworthy. I mean, there was a style, even when you guys started in 2014, there was a style in which videos and internet videos and everything in between were trying to get your attention. They were writing in a way that was like, you need to look at this now, or, you know, 10 things that, you know, remind you that you're just like Beyonce. Whatever it was, but the point being, that is even changing and evolving as time goes on.
Yeah, that's still part of our DNA, but like, we have sort of changed as that sort of like clickbait as we knew it, when it sort of got a lot of attention and people suddenly realized, like, oh, we're reading things in a different way on the internet now. Like, there's different ways that people are trying to get our attention. That has morphed over time. And part of how it's morphed is like the thing that we're doing with Anita Hawkins, is that you have politicians now who are trying to get your attention all the time.
Right.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I feel like at the beginning when Clickwell started in 2014, things were very emotional in an Upworthy sense, in that they were just like, look at this video of a pit bull, like, it will make you cry. And now it's like, look at this video of Trump, it will make you scream. And it's just like, the emotions are still there, but it's, the internet just gets like emotional about different things in different ways. So we try and parody.
I mean, you guys almost in a way are anthropologists as your job as comedians, to look at exactly how we're using the internet and how the internet changes, and keep that focal point on the fact that it pretty much is all the same, just maybe the names have changed.
I would not give us that much credit. we'll take it. We're very fancy.
Very distinguished.
Yeah, very distinguished, very important work. I mean, like, we're just trying to make, like, jokes about the stuff that, like, we see, like, out there, and hopefully people like it, and that's, yeah, we're happy.
I mean, obviously, there's a lot that the Onion continues to win. I mean, even in this new movement of fake news, and everybody talks about how, you know, the internet is just rife with it. I mean, it's funny how many times the Onion gets caught up in that. Clickhole as well, where someone will call it out, this is fake news, or they share it in a way that they don't recognize the brand or the Onion. And also being right there at the right time to have an opportune headline to capture what people are thinking about. That is a skill that we still talk about. I mean, we still recognize as Americans is something that the Onion provides and nobody else does. Do you guys recognize that there is this responsibility that the Onion, as things get crazier and crazier and more surreal around us on the internet, that the brand that you guys work for, Clickhole and the Onion, continues to have this relevance and this need?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, that's part of why we still have jobs, you know,
yeah.
Probably is that there's some people who like this and appreciate sort of the catharsis that comes with, like, going, like, looking at a Onion headline and going, like, that is like that. I do see that kind of article all the time now. Like, it feels good to see someone pointing at it as well. I think that's true.
Yeah, and it's like cool to work at a website where so much of what we talk about in the room is making sure that the joke is not perceived as fake news.
Right.
If we think it feels even remotely real, we'll kill the headline right then.
Really?
Yeah. Because we don't want to be misinterpreted as, yeah, like, fake news.
And I would only assume, Lauren, you've been there for a while, you both have been there, but I mean, I would assume that wasn't a concern 3 to 5 years ago. I mean, I don't know if the Onion was sitting in a room going, this is too real, we need to kill it. I mean, has that been because of this backlash that we've seen with people calling out that the news on the internet is not credible?
Oh, I mean, I feel like for as long as I've been there, like, long before this political climate started happening, we'd always talk about how we didn't want our news to be perceived as fake. Because some people just don't know what the Onion is, and they don't know what Clickhole is, and it is pretty easy for just, like, someone of a certain age to see a headline and be like, oh no, like, what's that saying? Obviously now it's become a lot more intense.
Yeah. But definitely, yeah, before, like, fake news was like fake news as we know it now, we it's definitely a thing that we've not wanted to be construed as, even though we are making jokes here. We want people to, like, get it's a joke and, like, laugh at it. That's our goal.
When you have projects like Patriot Hole or the Senator Anita Hawkins, as part of being a great comedian, as you mentioned Anita Hawkins, you look at it like a series, is when it's over. right? When do you recognize it's over? Do you run Anita Hawkins as long as you possibly can till you squeeze every bit of viral success you can out of this character? But as comedians and editors and everything that you guys have been, you know, the professionals that you are, do you have to think about when the bit is over?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if I don't really see the kinds of videos that we're parodying with Anita, like, going away, but like they'll probably change, and when that happens, then the series will have to change, or maybe, you know, it'll have to become a different series if in order to really sort of parody what's really sort of like in people's feeds right now. But also, you know, like we stop doing things when we get tired of them, we feel like we need to move on to whatever is fresher and newer and feels interesting to us, because we're selfish people and we just want to do what we want to do. But right now this is interesting. Yeah.
All right, well, in studio, Noah Preswich, Lauren Moser. They're both writers, senior writers, head writers at Clickhole, clickhole.com. It's the internet parody arm of The Onion. They do videos and other things. Follow Senator Anita Hawkins from California. Just look it up. Both her Facebook, Twitter. I'm sure she's on Instagram. I wouldn't be surprised if she's other places as well. Friendster, whereas somewhere down the line. Upworthy, I'm sure she's got spots on Upworthy. Great to meet you guys, and I'd love to have you guys back. Appreciate you coming in.
For sure, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, Greg Flam's going to be back with another installment of the Swap Meet. This is a great segment where we ask you to go into your basement, into your crawl space, maybe out into the garage, find the stuff that you just can't throw away. Something that you're like, I've moved. I've taken this stuff with me. I've moved from place to place. I cannot get rid of it. Call in and find out what it's worth. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, my guest every Thursday night, 312-981-7200. That is coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, so start brainstorming on that. Well, my next guest is a filmmaker who's one of the leading creative voices behind local hip-hop music videos. Aziz Alaka is the man behind Laka Films, a production company that shoots rap videos for Chicago artists like G Herbo, Lil Bibby, Famous Dex, and Rico Reckless, just to name a few. And if you go to Laka Films' YouTube account, you'll see hundreds of videos with millions of views. Laka Films is one of the production companies that's created a look for the drill rap scene in Chicago. Yes, there's plenty of guns and dancing women, but what Aziz has done has used Chicago as his backdrop. Downtown, neighborhoods, alleyways, living rooms. It's a very distinct look at a city that we live in and the visual soundtrack for the lives of many hip-hop artists coming up in Chicago today. Aziz Alaka, Laka Films, my guest on the download tonight. Laka, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm a fan of your work. I've been watching your videos all day today, and I've known a lot of them from seeing them at different points being shared in other ways. Talk about how you got into this. I mean, you obviously are the man behind Laka Films, and we're talking millions of views on this stuff. How did you first get into the idea of shooting music videos?
Honestly, I used to do like a lot of comedy videos, and then I stepped into like parody videos, and it's like very creative. So like when I stepped into that lane, I was paying people to do my parody videos, and I was like, maybe I should do this myself. And then I started taking like classes at U-Media down the street, and I had this mentor, Jeff Lassan, who kind of taught me like how to really edit. And I used YouTube and a lot of tutorials and a few friends, and then I just started like shooting music videos for myself. Well, parody videos for myself, and then music videos for others. So I kind of like slipped into this lane, but then I found like it was special and I liked it.
Well, I mean, talk about the first music video that you did. Can you go back there and say, I mean, because when you see the videos, a lot of them, they have the DIY spirit. They're do-it-yourself. There are a lot of videos in living rooms. Maybe you clear out the furniture and you can see it. You know it's a Chicago living room. You could tell from the octagon kind of front of it, but you'll have the artist and maybe his crew behind him and friends. Talk about, can you recall the first music video that you shot?
Yes, I can. The first music video I shot was with someone I went to elementary school with at Ariel Community Academy. We actually broke into like an abandoned school building by Holy Angels. and like I didn't have lights, I didn't have anything. It was pretty dark, and we shot like in this cafeteria, and then we shot in the hallways, and we shot by this locker room. Like, we just created nothing out of something. It was just like very weird how we went to like this school together, and then it's now,
and then you're in there,
and now we're in there illegally.
Yeah, but the inn is closed, so that's okay.
Yeah,
a lot of the videos that even some of the artists that we talked about, and some of them are now breaking in the way that they're not even in Chicago anymore. But I'm fascinated about what your vision is when it comes to putting a video together. How much of it is staged? How much of it is pre-planned? Are you storyboarding this stuff? Or is it, I got a camera, I got 2 hours, let's go downtown, let's see what we can shoot in front of Water Tower.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like when I first started, I didn't even know some of the songs I was shooting. Like, my biggest song ever, which was Drift From My Walk, that was, like, my favorite video. When I made it, and we shot it in, like, 20 minutes. I didn't even want to shoot it. And it was in the same house we shot 8 other videos in. So, like, I was like, it's no way. And then it just became a hit, and it was like, wow. I didn't know this would be, like, the main single hit that made this famous Dex blow. And, like, it was just, like, a whole life-changing experience. And it was just shocking because it's just, like, we don't really pre-plan, you know. We just had this little schedule. I go to school, so my off days were Wednesday. And, like, Famous Dex had kind of lost his mother around this time. So, like, it was just, like, a compassionate, like, I felt for him, and we were kind of friends. And he was like, I want to be a rapper. So we just start shooting every week. Every Wednesday, we'll link up in his house in Inglewood, and then we'll try to plan somewhere around. And when we couldn't find him, we'll just shoot in the house, and we'll just shoot in different areas of the house. You wouldn't even know we shot
the same
over
house,
10
right?
videos in there. Like, it was crazy.
Were you a fan of his music? Do you have to be a fan of the music that the videos that you create?
Do I have to be a fan of the music? Kind of not. It's a lot I look at. Like, my favorite thing when I've, like, watched videos growing up, I like energy. Like, most of the people that I work with, I just like energy. Like, I don't even care what you're talking about. As long as you can stay on beat, that's a whole nother thing. You make that with your engineer. Like, with me, if you can dance in front of the camera, if you can attract attention, if you can make something from nothing, that's when I wanna, like, that's when I like you. That's when I'm like, oh. Like, he used to dance, and he just used to bring energy, and, like, everybody have their own charisma. Like, even Rico Reckless, somebody I work close with, like, if you ever met him, very entertaining. Like, a lot of people I work right. with, genuinely just funny, entertainment,
they
entertaining.
Have to, they have to pop off the pan. I mean, they have to be the star in the middle of the screen.
Exactly. But when people see these people online, they just look at them like, oh, very ignorant, locked up, you know. Social problems, et cetera, minister society. This is like what they're labeled as. But when you meet them, you realize like they're normal humans like me, and they just like to laugh and like to have fun. They just happen to grow up in bad neighborhoods and get influenced by bad things.
It's such an interesting dichotomy because I think about I was watching one of the Famous Dex videos. I think it was Shooters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the beginning, and I knew the story that you came from comedy. And there's a beginning of that where they say, put your hoods up, and they're all holding guns, and they run off to go do their thing. You could tell in the moment that that is a sketch. That is not necessarily – they're not actually doing that. That's a thing there. But how much of it is designed to be entertainment as opposed to be documentary that shows an artist in its environment or his or her environment?
Okay, so like some is like documentary where it just kind of like show you like – what rappers have been through, and then some is like fake stage, but it's like quick staging. It's not like, oh my god, all these lights. It's just like, let's plan. Like, that's actually based off some stuff that's actually happened in real life, like where they either have friends, you know what I'm saying,
yeah,
that
right.
just like are about to go bust into somebody's crib, put hoodies on with guns, and about to rob a crib that's in that neighborhood, you know. So like, it's just like replicating like what's happened in real life.
The reason I ask, and I'm fascinated by it, I remember being introduced to G Herbo and Lil Bibby through Kill S, you know, like but what was really fascinating to me was getting a sort of window into their lives, standing on the stoop, who they were hanging out with, what they were decided to shoot cut to cut to cut. And being a guy who is in a studio downtown Chicago, doesn't understand that life, maybe not in, not presence in my life, it was, it does come across as almost documentary style. How much that, that's I guess my point, that a lot of that stuff has become almost a video anthem for the streets of Chicago.
Yes.
And you're a big part of that. So talk about, is that the intention? Is the intention to show real life on the streets of Chicago? Or is it fun games and we're just having a blast and we're kind of entertaining? We're not, this isn't real.
I mean, it's a mix of both. Like, the main thing is, okay, we're showing you this is the streets of Chicago. Like, this gang stuff is real. Like, these sneak dissing songs are real. Like, it's certain areas they cannot go to. It's certain people who haven't even came downtown and lived in Chicago their whole life. Like, it's real. Like, if you look at any of these people and you look at their friends, if you looked at them, they're locked up. They're dead. I don't know if you've ever heard any of these songs where they're RIP this, RIP this, yeah. RIP this, RIP this. Like, a lot of songs are about, like, how they've lost close homies and have their how they lost their brothers and all these people they grow up with. And when you go to their communities, it's like that, for real. Like, when you go outside, they really are 50 deep on the block, kicking it, smoking, drinking. You know what I'm saying? Somebody has a gun to make sure they're protected.
What I love about it, and I think the question is, you're not like that, meaning that's not your lifestyle necessarily. You're a videographer. You're a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And so the question is, do you feel at all any sort of responsibility as a filmmaker to say, all right, maybe not so much on the guns. Maybe not so much with everything that's happening in Chicago. Maybe 10 million people are going to view this, many of them being kids who are going to look up to these artists. Do you feel at all any sort of responsibility to say, you know what, maybe one gun, not ten. You know, but you see what I'm saying with that?
Yeah. Okay, so, like, I've been having, like, this debate with actually some people in this room, to be honest. and it's just, like, when I first started, it was just, like, I kind of want to show this. Like, you know, this just actually shows poverty, and it shows, like, gentrification, and it shows, like, how people start off with, like, nothing. And it was, like, when I started, I was, like, this is what I want to show. Because this is what other people won't do. You can't get other racists to come to the south side of Chicago to show other people doing these things. Like, it's certain people who won't even shoot on the south side of Chicago. So why can't they get the same privileges as someone on the north side or downtown?
Sure.
So, like, that's how I felt. But as I continue to enter the industry and continue to become more professional, I have been aware of these things, and I'm trying to work on these things. And actually, that's my goal for 2018, to actually take these individuals that are used to this certain lifestyle and just put them on sets. You know what I'm saying? Just make it a little bit more industry, where it's like, you don't need a gun to prove that you're from the streets. They know you're from the streets.
And there's something great about that evolution, both from you as an artist, but also the hip-hop artist. Because I think of artists like G Herbo or Lil Bibby, and you can even tell from the videos that start to come out now, they're much different than what they did 5 years ago. They are on sets. They're fancier cars and cooler houses and things like that. But beyond that, just they seem to find a way to move and evolve away from that. And a lot of that has to do with, I guess, with who the filmmaker is and what they want to accomplish.
I mean, honestly, a lot has to do with management. So, like, a lot of these people grab deals and they're influenced by all these people where they say, well, you can't sell this if you have a gun. You can't do this. You can't do that. So then they stop working with the cameramans from Chicago, because now half of them move. They in L.A. They in Atlanta. They're nowhere near Chicago because they're not trying to get shot. But, you know, at the end of the day, it depends on what the filmmaker wants to do. And, like, this year I'm going to level up. That's my 2018 goal, honestly. That's, like, what it is, what it was, what everything. Like, I was just talking about how I'm going to level up. Like, no more quick shooting. Let's come up with a little storyline, you know? And if you use a gun, let's have a meaning. Let's not just point it at the camera. And you can still show off your life. Like, if you look at some of G Herbo videos, like the last one he did, like Red Snow, oh my God, that video was amazing. Like,
but that's the point. Like, you can see that he's evolving as an artist, yeah.
Yeah. It, I mean, it was a gun in there and stuff, but it showed a storyline where it's like, he was too busy worried about the other person trying to steal, and now he done walked out and stole something, and it was just like was so story, much. Right. It was just beautiful. So, like, I'm trying to evolve that way.
Aziz Alaka in studio. He is the man behind Laka Films. We're talking about his career as a young man who has shot hundreds of hip-hop videos in Chicago with different Chicago artists. You know, as we wrap up, you talked about what you want to do for 2018. For you as an artist who really has put a signature on a lot of this music, how do you see yourself evolving? Do you see yourself working with other artists, getting outside of Chicago? I've seen through your social media channels different artists, bigger artists that you're hanging around with. Do you see yourself following a career path and making this your career as a music video director?
This is something I think about every day. I mean, I've been blessed with opportunities to work with, like, the greatest in the game. I worked with Lil Pump recently. I done did some things with Trippie Redd, Ski Master, Slump God. Like, with me, it's like I figure out who's kind of local. That's who I like. I don't really like when people become industry, that's a whole nother level. I don't like management. I don't like it's not fun. It's not friendly. I like when I can DM Trippie Redd and he said, oh yeah, let's link up, let's meet in the studio, and then we shoot a video and we do something creative with it, you know, and we put mountains even though we're in LA and we're just dancing down the strip. So it's still like that run and gun, fast paced, but it's just a little bit more concept. Let's make it a little more trippy while we still add a little bit more industry to it.
My last question is just about Chicago and as a backdrop, because you, in all the videos, it has always inevitably will be a spot where it'll be something about Chicago, whether it's Michigan Avenue right here or whether it's a neighborhood in Chicago. But the point being, how important is this city and how photogenic is this city for you as an artist who continues to shoot these music videos?
Man, I just love Chicago. Like, I've been to many places, like, probably been to, like, 25 out of 50 states, and none of them are better than Chicago. Like, they have their advantages. Like, L.A. is cool, it's hot, but it's not Chicago. Chicago is beautiful, and we have, like, a history, we have a culture, we have so many people from here, Kanye, Nas, Common, like, multiple, like, hip-hop artists, and we had a breakthrough in 2012 with Chief Keef, with Drill, you know, like, it's just so much flavor in this city, and I love it. And now every time you just see someone break through, we have Chance the Rapper. Who has Chance the Rapper? Chicago, you know? So now we have Famous Dex. We just have so many powerhouses, and I just feel like it's so much potential in Chicago. Like, it's no reason to leave here. You just have to keep going, you know? Yeah. And you just have to keep pushing, and we need more creative directors, and we need more creative artists. And then, you know, over time, we'll bring more positive people. We have a lot of positive people. You know, you think they're not getting spotlighted, but they are. We have Chance. We have Vic. We have Mick Jenkins. We have so many. We can keep going for days. So it's there. We just have to keep building and just make it shine.
Yeah, and we have Aziz Alaka, who is Alaka Films, who produces hundreds of music videos here in Chicago for aspiring Chicago hip-hop artists and beyond. You can find out his information. It's on YouTube and social media, Instagram, Laka Films, L-A-K-A. Laka, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your story, and talking to us tonight on Download. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Yeah, I gotta say, man, it's amazing. I don't know how many of our listeners, I know I'm not the target audience of Aziz Alaka's videos, but there's 10 million views on some of that stuff, man. 10 million on YouTube. And you do, when you watch it, and it, again, you know, I'm this first time I'm going through and I'm watching his stuff, and it's amazing because it's a peek into a window. It's like a window. It's a view in. That's what the internet can do for you, to a different culture, to a different style, to a different part of the city, to a city that is misunderstood, but at the same time has a lot of trouble and problems. And a lot of it is around the culture that is portrayed in the videos. And so it's interesting to hear him talk about in 2018 wanting to evolve out of the style. And what he's talking about is one, and you can watch these videos, just go to Laka Films, one rapper with a couple of guys behind him. They're a lot of prop guns stuff like that. And they're pointing them at the camera. They're just, it's just, it's a very aggressive, violent display. And it's something that you don't even, I mean, there's the kind of Dr. Dre and the Snoop and stuff that we've seen on MTV growing up. So you're not like shocked by it, but it's much more raw. And it's much more do-it-yourself DIY in a, like I said, in an octagon front room of a south side apartment or a house. You can even see they bring the shades down, so it's almost, but you could tell it's in the living room of the house. It is, I mean, you go and talk about going down a rabbit hole. And you go down a rabbit hole when you start looking at that stuff. And I don't know, it helped, I think in a way it helps me understand, you know, when you have 10 million views of what's happening in the city of Chicago that gets played out in the newspapers and national storylines, things like that.
And meanwhile, I, you know, think that, you know, oh my God, this band is the biggest thing in the world. And I look at their YouTube page and I 626 views.
Like the 80. Great guitar playing. Yeah, but I, you know, and I don't know how it all works out, but I mean, it is, there is a, I mean, Famous Rex is good, or Famous Dex is a great example of a rapper who is well known in Chicago. You know, the kind of thing where you're like, oh my gosh, sure, if he does a show, it's going to be bubbling up. Again, probably not too many people in the WGN audience is going to the Famous Dex show underground. Maybe. All right, moving on. Swap Meet coming up, 312-981-7200. I'm excited. What do you got in your attic, your basement, your garage? Now's the time to go get it, unwrap it. Don't take it out of the package. Wait, Dad, let me rephrase. Take it out of its outside package. Don't take it out of the package. And let us know what you got coming up here. Greg Flamm.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
Here I am.
Here he is. Greg Flamm is back in the building at That's DuPage right. Picker. It is time for another edition of Swap Meet. This our segment we do every Thursday night where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia. We ask you to go down to the basement.
Do maybe some digging.
Go up to the attic. Maybe it's hanging in the foyer. Maybe your family is like, please, for the love of God, please get rid of that. And you're like, nope, it's worth something. And I'll prove it tonight.
Right, we will.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. You can text, you can call. And if you want to know what something's worth or you got something that you want to brag about, now is the time to do it. Greg Flamm, it's been 2 weeks. Good to see you, bud.
Good to be back.
How you doing? How's the winter treating you?
You know, I only went to one estate sale in the last 2 weeks, but it was a great one.
Oh,
I
had good.
All kinds of, it was a family member of RZA's Chevrolet, and they had so many promotional stuff from the Bears, Bulls. I mean, just so much stuff. And I walked out of there with some great stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when you walk in and they're like, this is the estate of Joe Rizzo Ford.
You know, I'm kind of probably speaking out of school, but they don't normally announce that. But you could tell by the stuff that was there, there was a ton of Rizzo Chevrolet stuff.
Well, interesting.
But yeah, thanks to them.
All right, so what do we got here? What do you want to brag about? What'd you bring in? I see already that we've got some awesome Bears stuff.
You know, you see one Bears poster, you think you've seen them all, but I have never owned these, the size of these. And they're... 1987, the Bears are back posters. They're kind of mini posters, and they have, you know, the fake signature on them. But I've never had a Dave Duerson of this size poster or the Hampton, which Hampton, you would think, you know, it's pretty popular.
So these are the Osco Drug, not the Jewel Osco. This is Osco Drug.
Mm-hmm, before they merch.
Right? This is Bears are back. The Bears are back, and you've got three posters. You got one of Dave Duerson signed.
Mm-hmm.
He got a Dan Hampton signed. That one, he looks regal.
And it's not live ink, just for...
Oh, it's not?
Yeah.
And then you got a Neil Anderson, too.
Yep.
There you go.
And I could not find any sold or available on the Duerson or Hampton.
Really?
Neil Anderson, there were a couple, a $13 poster, but none on the other. So I'm hoping the auction does well on those.
Well, the Dan Hampton poster, it looks like he's looking at the photographer, and he's got those like big shoulder pads, and you just see how tall he is.
Yeah.
Man, that's a classic. These are classics, Greg.
Yep. So it's nice to finally come across this because there's so many Bears posters. And it's just nice to see something that you don't normally see.
Yeah.
I did also get a 1991 NBA Finals Bulls poster, large poster, you know, from Chevrolet and Geo back then. But
classic,
so that was
kind of
cool. I got a 91-92 NBA Finals shirt. I mean, T-shirt, you know.
Our family had a Geo Tracker. I don't want to make a big deal about it.
Yep.
But it kind of was a big deal.
Yeah, my ex got in an accident with a semi in a Geo Tracker and survived.
Oof. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were not the most secure
vehicles.
Before we move on, the Osco drug commercial poster in the corner, they have. What are the items they have? They actually have items that they're selling. What are those?
These are all like Kodak items, batteries, film, and then the Osco drug logo. But, you know, it's Kodak and they've got batteries. I know they make batteries, but that's not what they're known for.
Yeah, right. The Kodak batteries. Well, yeah, there you go. All right. What else you got here?
I brought a bunch. I collect maps, and I came across a whole bunch of like 50s and 60s.
Yeah, this is like
Sinclair
gas station.
Old Standard.
Yeah.
And if you're hunting for maps or you want to sell them, the best ones are you want the gas station logo as big as possible on the map. And I'll show you what I mean. Like this mobile one, not worth much because there's not much going on there. But this Sinclair, yes, you want this. It's got the dinosaur, you know. This is what you want. This is the type of, you know.
The standard, yeah.
Yeah, you want the gas station logo as big as possible, and those tend to get the most money.
I love it.
Yeah.
So, all right. Great
tip of the week.
That's a good start. 312-981-7200. I feel like I was, you know, because it was so cold, I was trying this week. I was in my garage. I was moving some stuff around, and I found all of the Mayor Daley posters.
Okay.
Right? I still have those. I have a lot. I feel like the last time we brought it up, there was a lot of interest, and I feel like they're sitting in there, and I'm not doing much with them, but I want to, as part of the swap meet, get in a position where maybe, I don't know, we figure out a way that I can give some of these away.
Yeah.
Right?
That'd be great.
Because they're not worth anything.
Yeah, I can meet them at the flea market. If you get a winner, they can meet me there to get it, or we can, whatever.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
You know, whatever.
Yeah, I'm
you
not
do.
Mailing it. There's no way I'm
right.
mailing it.
And but I'm sure you have some stuff that
either.
Is not, yeah, right. I'm sure there's, you know, some stuff that is kind of rare, you know, some of the Daley stuff. You just, you know.
Yeah. It's Mayor Daley, and it's a 1983. So it was when he lost to Harold Washington.
Right.
It's a bunch of posters and bumper stickers or stickers that were given to me at some point. I found them. I pulled them out like that. I've got the biggest find in the world. And I brought them in here, and you're like, no, they're not worth anything.
You didn't make a deal for like an extra garbage can or something. You had to pick it or what did they call that?
Yeah. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text, you can call, and we'll take a quick break right now. And when we come back, we'll start the bidding. I don't know if it's bidding, but it's just the swap meet.
The swap.
Stay with us. It's a swap meet here on the download, 720 WGN. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. And of course, you, 312-981-7200. It's your chance to brag about the cool stuff you've collected over the years and see if any of that junk that you've brought from house to house, from room to room, that you have on display in the foyer, if it's worth anything. 312-981-7200. Let's start tonight with Sharon. Sharon, what do you want to brag about?
I've got a Mattel little alien in a spacecraft. It's called the Cosmic Kittles.
Mm-hmm.
He's Dello Martin. He's got that purple rock that he sits on.
Right.
Now, his spaceship is different than any of my seen. Top of his is yellow, and the bottom is blue.
Okay.
Why do you have this, Sharon? What is the, is this just a toy left over?
It was something that was bought to me years ago, and I just take him with me.
Do you happen to have any of the
Martian.
The packaging or the boxes or anything with it?
No. Okay. He's on a purple rock that he rocks onto the rock.
Where he should be.
I have to ask, because it affects the value, of course.
Okay.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've sold some of the little Kittles, they were called. You put them on like these little, like,
right.
bicycle type thing. You push it.
Spacecraft.
Right, and this one's in a spaceship, and in excellent condition. They've gone as high as about $100, $120. Without the box and maybe what you're talking, you're probably, I would do an auction starting maybe at like $25, $30 and see if it goes up from there. Like you said, you might have a rare color that wasn't made very much or limited.
The nostalgia factor, Sharon. I'd keep it.
Oh, yeah.
I'd keep it. You're taking it from place to place, and it's a little kittle and a spacecraft.
For that amount of money.
At this point, I'd hold on to it.
Yep.
Right. Okay.
Thanks, Sharon.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Judy. Judy, what do you want to brag about, Judy?
Well, I'm not bragging. I am just really curious. When one of my grandmothers died, I got a bunch of furniture. One is a... It's a piece of furniture. It's made of hardwood. It's made by Admiral.
Mm-hmm.
And it has tubes in the back. You pull out a drawer. And, I mean, this is a good-sized piece of wood.
Sounds like a classic.
Is it taller than it is wide? Because I kind of know what you're talking about. I just want to narrow it down.
It has, like, lattice work on the floor. Okay. One side, when you pull a drawer out, is a photograph. The other is a radio, only AM.
Okay.
So I am wondering how much.
Sure.
Yeah. Is it taller than it is wider?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So that helps. Let's see.
I mean, I didn't get. Tape measure up because I can't find it.
No, I understand. No,
can you tape measure? Can you measure it for us right now? I'm kidding.
I'm on the driveway.
I'm joking.
No, you have a good find. Some of the Admiral consoles can go as high as $3,000. Some are as low as $150. Again, that falls into that category that it's hard to move. So it's going to be if you do sell it, it's going to be a local pickup. Like either a Craigslist or an antique shop on consignment, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
And that tends to make people price it lower than it should be, really. So if you have the patience and can keep it for a while and you can stick to your price, maybe shoot for $1,200 or $1,500.
Yeah. Somewhere in the middle, right? Somewhere between $100 and $3,000.
Right, and they're all over the place because it's different models. Can I ask, does it have the lattice on both sides?
She dropped out. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. Let's pretend that the lattice is on.
Yeah, I'm assuming the lattice was just on one side of it. So,
yeah. Let's go to Jake. Jake, what do you want to brag about, Jake?
Hey, G, how you doing, gentlemen?
Good.
I got a couple of Walter Payton items. I got a box of him and a Wheaties box from 1986. It's still in the cellophane, never been opened.
Okay.
And I also have two bottles of Walter Payton Pilsner beer.
Wow.
Yes!
That I didn't even know until the guy gave me him. I didn't even know that he had made a beer, quite honestly.
I love it. I love when you start getting to the second tier stuff that athletes made that you don't even know they made. Beer is a good one for Payton.
The Wheaties, if it's obviously not signed, I'm assuming, they start at about 10 to 15, they start. And there's quite a few on there, so that's not so rare. But let me... look of the beer.
So three, I mean, we probably paid $3 for the box, right? Probably in a day, right? So you're not really, that's not a huge investment or, return on investment. You would think, I always get thrown off on that because you would think that that's a 30-year-old box of cereal. You'd think it'd be more than $10.
Yep.
What do I know?
I'm not finding the Walter Payton beer other than like an old style commemorative can goes for $11.
Now, this is a bottle of Walter Payton Pilsner beer. It's made by the All-American Brewing Company. I don't know if that's something he just created. I didn't know it. I was given it to a bartender.
I love that. Is it just one bottle?
In Grand Rapids, Michigan gave it to me.
Nice.
Wow, that could be rare because I'm not finding any yet.
That's awesome.
So
that's my favorite one. There you go, Jake. You're winning tonight.
Yeah, if you want to send a picture through Facebook, I can look it up.
You never even hit, there's nothing on there
nothing.
At all?
I'm not finding the bottle of beer. No, I'm just finding like old style did a commemorative can. That's it.
Okay.
We'll do a little more research, but that's interesting. Thanks, Jake.
Well, thank you guys.
Thanks for calling.
I've never heard of that either. That's interesting. I like that. All right.
That's a rare one.
Now we're picking up some steam. Now we're cooking with gas. Let's go to Paula. Paula, what do you want to brag about, Paula?
Hi. Well, they're four little. And they're not deep bowls. They're like dessert dishes or soup dishes. They're sort of flat with just a small indentation, so they're kind of fancy as opposed to a bowl.
Okay.
And they're Haviland. I've heard Haviland is a name that's good. I'm not really sure.
Haviland, like H-A-V-I-L-A-N-D?
I think it may be two L's in it. I'm not sure.
Mm, okay. Well, they spell it that way.
Oh, man. I yeah, without the right spelling. I'm not familiar with that brand. Again, not my niche that I'm in, but I'd be happy to try to find
fancy,
it.
Fancy-looking dishes for soup or not your thing? Greg, you look like a fancy soup
I know.
Guy.
I'm a Pyrex guy. I can appreciate Pyrex.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
You know,
sure.
When it comes to Haviland, I'm not familiar. But, yeah, if you again, send a picture, I'll be able to have
pictures will help. You know, thanks, Paula.
Thanks. Bye. Oh,
sorry.
630 says the beer you're speaking of was from Walter Payton's Roundhouse in Aurora back in 1996. It was open until about 2011. Mm-hmm. America's Brewing Company was the brew pub part of it.
Okay, yeah.
So that gives you a little bit more.
Sure. I thought it'd be older than that.
Yeah. Let's go to Aaron. Aaron, what do you want to brag about, Aaron?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. So I believe what I have is a 1911 German World War One trench knife.
Wow.
I believe it was banned by the Geneva Convention, and I saw that somebody actually had it on Pawn Stars as well.
Okay.
And they didn't have the sheath for it. I've actually got the leather wrapped sheath for it as well.
Where did you come across this? Is this like a family heirloom kind of thing, or is this something you picked up somewhere?
Yeah, it was given to my dad by my grandfather, who I believe brought it back from Europe during World War II, and it was then given to me.
Wow.
So yeah, the German knife is trench stamped knife. 1911. Yeah, it's a triangular shaped blade.
Okay.
So it's called a spike knife.
Okay.
And because of the wound that it would cause, it couldn't be sutured. It couldn't be stitched up.
Oh,
so that knife was actually banned by the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, okay.
And I think also because of the length of the blade as well.
Okay. Wow. That's good.
The knife is stamped 1911, and the sheath is stamped 1912.
Okay. I love it. Love it.
Let me see.
Man, we're getting some good stuff tonight, man. That's a good one.
Oh, man.
Trench knife.
They're coming up with a bunch of trench knives. Let me try to sort
this. Yeah, it's got like a rounded arch over the hand grip with spikes on it that would be used for like punching.
Okay.
And then it had like a metal knob on the end.
Yeah, because
it's a
weapon.
Yeah, and
it sounds
pretty rare as well. I mean, the highest when you look up trench knives, German trench knives, 1911, 1912, the highest ones are 700. But I have a feeling you have something more rare that would be worth more than that. What did the Pawn Stars guy say? How much was theirs worth?
You know, I don't even really remember.
Yeah, no problem.
I just remember the guy he was kind of talking about what it would be used for, and he said he would.
Ugh.
You would punch him, you would bop him on the top of the head, and then you would stab him with the knife. And
wow.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. It's deadly.
Jeez.
All right.
All right. Well, it sounds like you got something very valuable there, Aaron. Thanks for the call.
All right. Well, thank you.
That's good.
Thank
you. There you go. Wow. There we go. We're getting somewhere.
Some different stuff.
Some good stuff tonight. 312-981-7200. We've got, we got Bill, we've got Jim. Got a lot of texts coming in. We'll take a quick break so we can get the news tonight. We'll come back. We'll go right to the calls that are waiting. Next, it's the Swap Meet 312-981-7200.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware, as long as it's old. Has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Second half, let's do it.
That's right, let's do it. 312-981-7200. We're playing a Swap Meet. Always fun. So many great people texting in
and
calling in. 773 says, how about a photo strip of Justin and his comedy troupe, Schadenfreude, blitzed off their butts at our wedding? Is it bad? I don't know. Then I'm like, James? I can only guess, right? That's funny. 312-981-7200. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's get to the people who've been waiting. Let's go to Bill. Bill, what do you want to brag about, Bill?
Hi, gentlemen. I have a 70s Czechoslovakian lithograph of Charles Bronson from the movie Mr. Majestic.
Come on. That helps. That's amazing. That's a win. How much do you want for it?
I have no idea.
What does it look like? Is it when you say lithograph? Is it like
it's a painting? It's like a frontal portrait of Charles Bronson in like deep colors with the movie titled Mr. Majestic below it and the Czechoslovakian writing. And I got it from a girl that I knew in the 70s that worked at an art shop in Villa Park on Route 64.
Wow. Well, it's definitely rare. I'm not finding anything like
that's
that.
The best one of all time.
Yep.
I'll trade my Mayor Daley poster for that in a heartbeat. Like, that's awesome. Charles Bronson's the best.
Yep.
Yes, it's a good one.
In lithograph form? Czechoslovakian lithograph form?
Yes.
There ain't nothing to be. What's going to beat that?
Yeah,
that should be priceless.
Yeah, you have to be in the 300 or 400 to start range if you auction that off, I think. Because some of his other movies are going for about $100 for the poster for some of his other movies. But obviously this is definitely more rare and more unique.
Wow, Bill, awesome.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you for calling. For lighting up my life with that one, man. That's a great one.
That would look
anything
good.
Charles Bronson, come on.
That would look good on the wall here.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Ron. Ron, what do you want to brag about, Ron?
Yeah, I got a Dale Earnhardt cookie jar.
Of course
you
do.
It's about a foot long.
It's a foot long?
Wow.
Yeah, it's got number 3 stamped into it.
So is it a car? Is it a car-like length?
No, it's a porcelain.
Okay.
The roof half top comes off.
Who makes that?
Cookies in it. Nabisco.
Wow.
They just made it. They're like, we're just going to make a porcelain jar and just wrap it in Dale Earnhardt's number?
So it's not the truck, right? It's a car? Because I'm seeing
The NASCAR itself.
Sure.
Oh.
All right. And
awesome. That's awesome. Do you still put cookies in it? It
looks like it's...
No.
Is it got Goodwrench on one of the side? Number 3, black and silver?
Right. Yeah, Mr. Goodwrench.
Yep.
There's one available now for 100 plus shipping, so that kind of gives you an idea right there. So I would think
Earnhardt fans.
You're in the $100 range, yeah.
There you go.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, man, we're getting some good stuff tonight.
Yeah, that's rare.
Let's go to Catherine. Catherine, what do you want to brag about?
Hi.
Hi
there.
Well, pre-Beatles, I have a poster that's called Silver Beatles, and it's with Pete Best.
Yes.
It's with Pete Best appearing at the Cavern Club, Liverpool, January 4th through
18,
1962. It had Pete Best, George Harrison, John Lennon, and Paul McCartney. So it's pre-Ringo, and I'm just wondering if this is worth anything.
Okay, first we have to ask, how long have you had it? Because they reproduce these posters
I do believe it is a reproduced one. I've had it about 4 years. I found it at a resale shop.
Okay. I'm going to guess it's a reproduction because there's so many on there, and they're usually in the $15 to $30 range, the reproductions.
No.
Obviously, you have an original one. That's huge money. But if you got it 4 years ago, I'm going to have to err on the side of reproduction.
Look at the sleuth. Greg Flan.
I see these concert posters and I look at them every time because I'm hoping that they're the original posters. Anything from
the thing
Frank
they caught
Zappa
my eye
and all that.
It is the Silver Beatles and not the Beatles. So that's what caught my eye. But
I'm looking at 4 of them right now on eBay for what I talked about, $15 to $30.
All right. Good. Well, I'll just keep them hanging.
Just keep
there. You go. It looks good. That's worth something. Thanks,
Thank
Catherine.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night.
I have 224 says I have all the Generation 1 Transformer toys in package, never opened, used with instructions. All Autobots and Decepticons and Minibots. I'd like to know how much they are as a set. I don't know if they sell them
that
way.
That is insane because
really?
Individually, some of them, just one in a box with the instructions, mint condition.
Like which one?
Like $800 just for one.
Like for Jazz?
For
Starscream?
I'm not a big guy.
For Ironsides? I could keep going. For Bumblebee?
I'll get it. I'll go with you here. Let's see. Grimlock.
That's one of the dinosaurs. Me, Grimlock.
$800 sold on back in November.
I had that one, Greg.
Yeah, in the
I had all
red
these
and
toys.
Black box top
one.
Yep.
I didn't keep it in the box. That's why I played with it.
Right. You got to buy two, like I said.
Yeah. And, I love those. You know,
so the whole lot of what he's talking about, that's many thousands of dollars if they're...
I tried to get my son the other... I was trying to find Transformers stuff to watch, you know, on and you remember there was a Transformers movie that starred... I think it was Orson Welles was in it. Or was it Marlon Brando? Maybe it was... No, I think it was Orson Welles. And it was from the 80s, 70s. And it was like a... it was a cartoon, but it was a 2-hour movie of it, and a lot of the Transformers, the Transformer ones, died.
Wow!
Like in the you know, they never died from the commercial or from the cartoon. They never died. They just got kind of banged up.
Right.
This one, they like right at the beginning, they killed them. That spoiler alert. That doesn't help. From the 1981. Well, right,
I was going to watch
movie.
That.
I tried to find it. I can't find it anywhere. It's not on Netflix. It's not on cable. Nothing.
You know, I'm 52, so it's kind of like that era of Transformers kind of just.
Oh man,
went over my head. G.I. Joe,
Insecticons.
Was great.
You don't like the Insecticons?
I'm not
Constructicons.
No, anything. All I know is if you see a Transformer made of diecast metal, grab it. I mean, yeah. I sold a foot of a Transformer that was diecast for like $56, just the foot. So yeah,
that's ridiculous.
Know, it is.
All right,
it's the world we live in.
Let's go to Jim. Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim? Jim, you there? No, we lost Jim. All right, let's keep going. Let's go to John. John, what do you want to brag about?
Well, I want to brag about a Masters green jacket that I won at an auction. It was signed by the winners of the Masters tournament from 1956 all the way up to 2007 when Zach Johnson won it.
How do you find? I mean, how do you do that?
So I was at my kids' school, little kids, and they had an auction for a private school, and I walked around the corner and I saw this Masters green jacket with everyone's signature on it, and I told my wife I got to get this, and she said just have a max bid, and when the auction started it was at my max bid, so I kept on raising my hand and she kept on punching me and long story short, I have this very expensive green jacket that I think it's going to be worth quite a bit. You know, some of the greats, Arnold Palmer, and
That's insane.
You
with
name it.
The amount of years that your jacket covers as far as signatures. Just one signed jacket is asking $26,000 on eBay, and that's what they're asking.
Wait, they want $26,000
for just one sign?
Come
they
on.
Don't say who signed
it.
So
he's got.
I know all those
so
years.
So that's gonna be hundreds of thousands of dollars. That
all
can't
those
be
years,
right.
Yeah.
That can't be right. I don't want to lead you on, John. That
right.
can't be right.
But you know, unfortunately, none sold for anywhere near in that amount, and no. Like signed jackets have sold recently, so that's something, you know, check into a sports auction site to, you know, maybe get a more realistic number.
If you want to continue to get under the skin of your wife, you should just wear it around tomorrow.
Right.
she wanted to put it right above our master bath urinal.
Nice.
No, but honest to God, so I looked into it because I thought this is so unique. Mm-hmm. Who donated it? What's going on with the story here? And I contacted the guy who donated it, and he did me like a huge favor. He actually sent me the photos.
Wow.
Of all the guys who signed the jacket. It, it was for free. Like, just gave me the photo, said this is a special thing.
That will definitely help when you get it appraised. Can we ask what you bid on it? What was the winning bid?
Yeah, so I paid $14,000 for it.
Maybe you're right. Maybe there's a chance for it to double in its value.
I'm sure. Yeah, at least double.
All right, wow. Well, thanks, John.
Good job. Good
Appreciate
story.
It. Good story. Thanks,
hey,
buddy.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, 312-981-7200. Let's take our last break. We'll come back. We'll get to John. We'll get to Jim. Aaron sent some pictures of that trench knife.
Okay,
so
great.
I'll show you that. And I got a bunch of texts to get to as well. It's a download. It's Swap Meet. Stay with us. All right, swap me 312-981-7200. I was right on it was James and Melissa's wedding. That the comedy group. Like to see those photos.
Good memory.
I don't remember being that blitzed. But maybe that's the issue, right? Years ago. Yeah. 312, there was hair in that video. Or that those pictures. I remember there was mop top Justin. 20-something mop top Justin. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Jim. Jim, what do you want to brag about, bud?
How you doing, guys? Listen, good. I got an autograph by Nelson Fox in an autograph book, regular size autograph book, in a page all by itself.
Okay.
Signed Nelson Fox.
Okay.
Oh.
I was wondering how much them. I got it in 1954.
You got it?
I got it in 1954.
How'd you get it? You just went down there and said,
"I want." He was appearing at a Sears promotional center or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing like Nelly Fox at a Sears.
Yeah.
Well, to get you to come down and buy a
that
blender.
Was five years before they won the pennant.
Oh, interesting.
Let's see.
And he never signed it, Nelly. He always signed his thing. Nelson.
Sure.
Interesting.
Yeah, it looks like they go for about $300 to $500 for just an autograph on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Wow. So not bad.
Okay.
All right, there you go.
Thank you.
Thanks, yep. Jim. He seemed nonplussed on that one.
Yeah.
No. Like, all right, forget it.
I'll just keep it.
John, John, what do you want to brag about?
I was watching H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, and he's going forward in time, and he's got the window. He's looking at the girl changing clothes. And one of the props in the window was about a 2-foot-tall bronze crane.
Hmm.
Well, lo and behold, I've had it for about 10, 15 years. I was cleaning out a basement or apartment building up on the North Shore. And it was in the basement, and it sure looked pretty neat. So I absconded with it, and I was wondering
what's it worth
from the time machine is. Yeah, it's it's well made. It's not a piece of junk, that's for sure.
It's a bronze crane, a movie prop from the time
crane.
Machine.
It's in the window. It's in the window when the girl changes clothes. And they take the clothes, put the stuff off. You'll see it in different parts of the
specific.
The window.
Yeah, I can't find a movie prop bronze crane, but just. Bronze crane, like antique bronze crane. Does it have a 1 foot high stand that is standing out, or is it just flat on?
It's it's a two leg standing on a base with the feet, and it's very, very nice looking. When you see the movie, you see it change. You see it. It's a couple different places when during the eras what they were going through. Put it in a couple different places. When I saw it, I just thought it was blue. I got that.
That's it. That's good. I think I found the one you're talking about. Obviously not from the movie, but I'm guessing $300 is what it sold for. But you know, nowadays you might be able to get a little bit more.
That's
for
a nice swipe from the basement.
I was just wondering if they might have poured a bunch of them or done something like that. Yeah,
probably.
More than one.
Yeah, if you could text or Facebook a picture, that'd be great, too. We can narrow it down.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, there we go. 312-981-7200. 630 says, I've collected Barbies since the early 80s. Who hasn't? Are any worth more than others? Like, is the Malibu Beach Barbie more than the...
Yeah, there are some that are worth more. The holiday ones, not so much anymore. Obviously, they have to be in, like, pristine condition from 80s and 90s because, you know, so many people were collecting Barbies by then. If you had 1952 Barbie, that's a different story. That's thousands of dollars. But by the 70s and 80s, it was a thing, and people were collecting them. So it really has to be smoke-free. Like, the tinted glass needs to be still clear, not sun-faded or anything like that.
I have some of those early 80s Barbies slightly used.
Okay.
One without a head.
Yeah,
missing a leg.
Playing with G.I. Joe, and
they're naked.
Got a little rough.
Lost the dress somewhere along the line, but so that's not worth anything.
Nope, 50 cents. Quarter bin at your garage. So.
Once again, 773. I have a John Kennedy campaign pin, and I have a Kennedy and Johnson campaign pin. What are those worth? Yeah, Pat says that.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't.
John Kennedy campaign pin, and then a Kennedy Johnson campaign pin. Going deep.
Yep. And let's see.
Do those kind of the political?
They do
pins?
Well. Yes.
I feel like that's a.
The pins tend to do better than some of the like magazines or paper ephemera from that era. And obviously, pins fall into ephemera. But let's see what we're getting here sold. And that would be, sorry.
It would,
you know, like 10, 20 bucks, for a pin. Maybe a little bit more.
630 says, Theo Haviland, China Patterns. This is from one of the people called in the Fancy Soup Bowl. Mm-hmm. Matters, the more gold encrusted, the more valuable it is. And then I believe 847 said, Haviland's a high-end porcelain China. It's lots of different patterns in production for 100 plus years. Value highly dependent on pattern and era. Way to go. Listen to Swap Meet Nation here.
They always come through.
847 and 630 giving us information where we did not have it before. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Let's keep going. Let's see. I've got antique. You know who called it or texted us back is Aaron. Aaron. Who was the guy with the trench knife. He sent us a couple of pictures. Yeah. And then he also sent us what he says was a bunch of, this is all the stuff my grandfather carried with him in World War II. His Zippo lighter, cigarette case, belt buckle, knife, and notebook. Took pictures of the Zippo lighter. And it looks legit. What does a Zippo lighter go for?
There some can be really great money. And they're in demand. I mean, as soon as you pull up to a flea market, that's the first thing people are asking. Do you have any Zippo lighters or do you have watches? If he could send a picture of what the side, if there was anything on the side of the lighter, we did see the pictures, but he had just the bottom and I just didn't have time to read everything on the bottom in small print. But I'd like to see what was on the side of those, if he could send that. But yeah, Zippo lighters are great money, especially if they're from that era. He's got a great find. It might be closer to what his knife is worth.
352s has an actual program, looks like the mass program from I guess this would be the funeral for John Kennedy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a program. There's a picture of the Cathedral of the Holy Cross, Boston, Massachusetts, Sunday, January 19th, 1964, Mozart's Requiem performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. It's essentially like a plaque program.
Wow.
For a solemn pontifical requiem mass in memory of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's worth anything.
Trying to get that.
All right. And while you look, I'm going to bring Scott in to finish us off. Sure. Scott, what do you want to brag about, Scott?
Well, let's get back to Barbie. I have, like, I think it's like a late 1980s or early 1990s. It's Ken and Barbie on the set of the Star Trek Enterprise.
Nice.
Dressed, you know, in Star Trek uniforms. Has never been played with, or I mean, it comes in the packaging that shows like the bridge of the Enterprise.
Sure. Wow, okay.
1990s, you said? Yeah. I've got right here one. Someone's asking 20 in the box. Let me see what some have sold for. $17.50, $18.50.
Oh, man, really not.
Like I said, they're really disappointing. You have to get into 70s or earlier. Or some of the play sets for Barbie, like the cruise ship or the dune buggy type thing, and in the box, you know.
If you want a half-folded Mayor Daley poster from 1983, I'm willing to trade on those Barbies, but something tells me that you're going to stick with the Barbie, Scott. Thanks for calling.
I do have a little political campaign that Jane Byrne signed with her picture.
Oh, yeah, nice. See, that's good. That's a good one. I like that stuff all the time, man. Yep. That's my favorite. That's probably worth nothing, but thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
No problem.
All right, that's going to do it for this week. Swap Meet, Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. If you want to follow up, just find him there, and you can send pictures and continue the conversation. He'll be back next week. Greg, always a pleasure. Great
always
job tonight.
Fun. Thank you.